Good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, May 13, 2019. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, access code 449-389-pound. If anybody would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, we're going to pick up where we left off last week in the Gospel of John. We're in chapter 17. This is Jesus prays for his own. And the whole chapter is a prayer that Christ is praying to the Father. And so I'm not going to break it up. It's like 26 verses, I believe. So we're going to read right through chapter 17, 1 through 26. I think it's through 26. Let me take a look. The Gospel of John, chapter 17, verses 1 through 26. These words spake Jesus, and lifted up his eyes to heaven, and said, Father, the hour is come, glorify thy Son, that thy Son might glorify thee, as thou hast given him power over all flesh, that he should give eternal life to as many as thou hast given him. And this is life eternal, that they might know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom thou hast sent. I have glorified thee on the earth. I have finished the work which thou gavest me to do. And now, O Father, glorify thou me with thine own self, with the glory which I had with thee before the world was. I have manifested thy name unto the men which thou hast given me out of the world. Thine they were, and thou gavest them me, and they have kept thy word. Now they have known that all things whatsoever thou hast given me are of thee. And I have given unto them the words which thou gavest me, and they have received them, and have known surely that I came out from thee, and they have believed that thou didst send me. I pray for them. I pray not for the world, but for them which thou hast given me, for they are thine. And all mine are thine, and thine are mine, and I am glorified in them. And now I am no more in the world, but these are in the world. And I come to thee, Holy Father, keep through thine own name those whom thou hast given me, that they may be one as we are. While I was with them in the world, I kept them in thy name. Those that thou hast given me, I have kept, and none of them is lost but the son of perdition, that the scriptures might be fulfilled. And now I come to thee, and these things I speak in the world, that they may have my joy fulfilled in themselves. I have given them thy word, and the world hath hated them, because they are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. I pray not that thou shouldest take them out of the world, but that thou shouldest keep them from the evil. They are not of the world, even as I am not of the world. Sanctify them through thy truth. Thy word is truth. As thou hast sent me into the world, even so have I also sent them into the world. And for their sake I sanctify myself, that they also might be sanctified through the truth. Neither pray I for these alone, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word, that they all may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. And the glory which thou gavest me, I have given them, that they may be one, even as we are one. I in them, thou in me, that they may be made perfect in one, and that the world may know that thou hast sent me, and hast loved them as thou hast loved me. Father, I will that they also, whom thou hast given me, be with me where I am, that they may behold my glory, which thou hast given me, for thou lovest me before the foundation of the world. O righteous Father, the world hath not known thee, but I have known thee, and these have known that thou hast sent me. And I have declared unto them thy name, and will declare it, that the love wherewith thou hast loved me may be in them, and I in them. The Gospel of John, chapter 17, verses 1 through 27. Okay, tonight's topic is going to be Article 3 Courts. Anybody who would like to follow along? It'll probably take us about 15 minutes to read through this. And if you'd like to follow along, you can go to the website, nationallibertyalliance.org. And underneath the grand jury, I like grand jury, come down to action against the judiciary. And you'll see a list of memorandum of laws, memorandums of law. And you click on Article 3 Courts. Let's see, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I think it's the 7th from the bottom. 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 from the bottom. Okay, Memorandum of Law, Article 3 Courts. Memorandum of Law on Article 3 Courts. The purpose of this memorandum is to clarify the jurisdictions of the federal district courts that are to proceed under law or equity. Whereas equity courts proceed under codes and statutes and presided over by a judge whose decision can be appealed to an appellate court that is presided over by a panel of judges. Law courts proceed according to the common law, without codes and statutes, and presided over by a jury of 12 people. The decisions in a court of law is final and cannot be appealed. There is no constitutional authority or legislative authority for the creation of an Article I tax court, which would be forbidden by Article I, Section 9, Clause 4, which states, no captation or other direct tax, which is a tax on salary or property, shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. United States Code, Title 26, states no jurisdiction and claims to be a court of record while operating under statutes, which is an oxymoron. A court of record is a judicial tribunal having attributes and exercising functions independently of the person of the magistrate designed generally to hold it, and proceeding according to the course of the common law, its acts and proceedings being enrolled for a perpetual memorial. Common law is distinguished from equity law. It is a body of rules and principles, written or unwritten, which are of fixed and immutable authority, and which must be applied to controversies rigorously and in there entirely, and cannot be modified to the suit the particularities of a specific case or colored by any judicial discretion. It is by the following words in our founding documents upon which all truth law rests, whereby we the people called upon God and made a covenant that no man can break. We read from the Declaration of Independence, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth separate and equal stations to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitles them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind, requires that they should declare the cause which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundations on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. God's covenant, founded upon the law of the land, is eternal and cannot be broken on behalf of another. This law is called common law because it is common unto all men, or natural law because it is innate, written in the hearts of men. Thereby, the authority vested in we the people, instituted by decree in our Constitution, created a republican form of government to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. We the people, through this Constitution, empowered elected and appointed servants to guard the same. The Constitution cannot be altered or abolished by the legislative servants who took an oath to protect it. Any judge who does not comply with his oath to the Constitution for the United States wars against that Constitution and engages in acts in violation of the supreme law of the land. The judge is engaged in acts of treason. Creation of Article 3 Courts. It is Article 3, Section 1, where authority is given to create courts. We, the people, vested power in only one Supreme Court, and empowered Congress to ordain and establish inferior courts, whereas judges hold office only so long as they are in good behavior. Article 3, Section 1. The judicial powers of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court, and in such inferior courts as Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. The judges both of the Supreme and the inferior courts shall hold their offices during good behavior. Good behavior is defined in Article 4, which is obedience to the law of the land, which includes natural law. Any judge not in good behavior would be in bad behavior and forfeits their office. Therefore, it is Congress's duty to impeach judges in bad behavior if they do not stand down. And if Congress cannot find the backbone to do their duty, then we, the people, will remove them via extraordinary indictments. Article 4, Clause 2. This Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuant thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. And the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Anything in the Constitution or the laws of any state to the contrary, notwithstanding. Congress has been given power to create only Article 3 courts of record, and equity ruled by American jurisprudence. Equity courts proceed under USC titles. Law courts, also known as courts of record, ought to proceed under natural law. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 9. The Congress shall have the power to constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court, as referred to in Article 3, Section 1. 28 USC, Subsection 132. Creation and composition of district courts. There shall be in each judicial district a district court, which shall be a court of record, known as the United States District Court for the district. Each district court shall consist of a district judge or judges for the district in regular active services. Justices or judges designated or assigned shall be competent to sit as judges of the court. Except as otherwise provided by law or rule or order of court, the judicial power of a district court with respect to any action, suit, or proceeding may be exercised by a single judge, who may preside alone and hold a regular or special session of court. At the same time, other sessions are held by other judges. Every federal district is to have a court of record, also known as natural law courts, which is presided over by the people, 12 jurists. No political judges permitted. When a judge sits as judge, it is an equity court under statutes or contract. Amendment 4 makes clear that judges cannot hear, decide, or sentence criminal cases. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed. Amendment 6. Authority to appoint judges and court officers. Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2. The President shall have the power to nominate, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint judges to the United States Supreme Court and all other officers of the United States whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law. But the Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the President alone in the courts of law. Article 3, Courts. Our Constitution provides for courts of equity and courts of law. The former is a court not of record, that is presided over by a judge whose decision can be appealed. The latter is a court of record, presided over by a tribunal, also known as a jury, whose decision is final and cannot be appealed. Article 3, Section 2. The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity. Courts of equity are courts not of record, that do not have the power to fine or incarcerate. They cannot hear criminal cases. They proceed in equity, which is the body of jurisprudence being a practical science that builds upon principles and self-evident truths synonymous with that of common law and the law of the land that all judges must obey. Equity supersedes the civil law in virtue, meting out impartial justice between two persons whose right or claim are in conflict. The tribunal is a judge bound by oath and an appellate structure made up of three or more judges. If the claim is over $20, each party has a right to choose a court of law, which is a court of record, which is the trial by jury. Amendment 7. In suits of common law, where the value controversy shall exceed $20, the right of a trial by jury shall be preserved, and no facts tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. Courts of law are courts of record that proceed according to the common law. All criminal cases require an injured party, and the state cannot be the injured party. The tribunal is a free and independent jury of 12 people whose decision is final and from which there is no appeal. It is we the people that bring an indictment, and the people decide the facts, the law, the remedy, and or penalty. Administrative courts are statutory. Equity courts that proceed according to statutes and do not yield to the common law, and whose end results are the will of the state. These courts do not have the power to fine or incarcerate and are called nisi prius courts. People are not obligated to participate in these courts unless they agree first. The law requires jurisdiction to appear on the record. Some examples of these kinds of courts are housing courts, Department of Labor courts, compensation courts, village courts, town courts, etc. Jurisdictions of Article 3 courts. Article 3, Section 2. The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and the treaties made of which shall be made under their authority. Admiralty and maritime jurisdiction cases where international laws apply under American jurisprudence. Equity jurisdictions proceed under codes and statutes whose jurisdiction is defined under USC titles. Law jurisdictions proceed under natural law. Courts that resist the Constitution. Judges have a duty by oath to support the Constitution and guarantee a republican form of government. Any judge acting upon seditious legislative acts joins the conspiracy of subversion. If the courts are to regard the Constitution and the Constitution is superior to any ordinary act of the legislature, The Constitution and not such ordinary act must govern the case to which they both apply. Those, then, who resist the principles that the Constitution is to be considered in a court as a paramount law and are reduced to the necessity of maintaining that courts must close their eyes on the Constitution and see only the law. This doctrine would subvert the very foundation of all written constitution. It would declare that an act which, according to the principles and theory of our government, is entirely void, is yet in practice completely obligatory. I would declare that if the legislator should do what is expressly forbidden, such act, notwithstanding the express prohibition, is in reality effectual. It would be given to the legislator a practical and real omnipotent, with the same breath which professes to restrict their powers within narrow limits. It is prescribing limits and declaring that those limits may be passed at pleasure. It is in these words I do solemnly swear that I will administer justice without respect to persons and do equal right to poor and to rich, and that I will faithfully and impartially discharge all the duties incumbent on me as according to the best of my abilities and understanding, agreeably to the Constitution and laws of the United States. Why does a judge swear to discharge his duties agreeably to the Constitution of the United States if that Constitution forms no rule for his government, if it is closed upon him and cannot be inspected by him? If such be the real state of things, this is worse than solemn mockery. To prescribe or to take his oath becomes equally a crime. Conclusion. Congress has been given power to legislate equity courts as defined under Article 1, Section 8. Said equity courts are governed by USC titles and American jurisprudence. Congress has been given power to provide for courts of record, also known as natural law courts or common law courts, where natural law and not statutes rule the court. Any court proceeding under statutes is not a court of record. Both law and equity courts are called United States District Courts, and all judges are bound to the law of the land and hold their office only when they are obedient to the law of the land. There exists no authority for Congress to create, or the judiciary to create, a jurisdiction called tax court. USC 26 states no jurisdiction and claims to be a court of record while operating under statutes, which is an oxymoron. A court of record proceeds according to the course of common law, not codes and statutes, and cannot be modified to suit the particularities of a specific case or colored by any judicial discretion, whereas a court of record is a judicial tribunal having attributes and exercising functions independently of the person of the magistrate designated generally to hold it. Congress has not been given the power to legislate codes, statutes, or regulations for Article III courts of record, which proceed according to the common law. Judges have no authority to railroad the people into jurisdictions foreign and unknown to the people. Any judge who participates in carrying the people away to jurisdictions unknown is guilty of fraud and high treason. Dated and signed, Grand Jury Foreman. Okay, this evening we're going to start things a little different than we normally do. By the way, am I coming through? Testing 1, 2, 3.
You sound great.
Okay, thanks. I don't know why I'm coming in under this thing as anonymous here, but I guess that's me. Okay, anyway, we're going to do things a little different starting tonight. You know, we get a lot of people who call and ask questions concerning cases and different things and how they may proceed. And so, first of all, we did put a page up with some information on how people can do certain things. We'll discuss that in a minute. But all these cases, they share the same problem. You know, the first order of business is to discover whether they have jurisdiction. So jurisdiction needs to be challenged. You will find they do not have jurisdictions most of the time. If it's a criminal case and, you know, and they're operating under statutes, then they don't have jurisdiction. If it's a case, a criminal case coming out of a town court, a village court, city courts, and so on, again, if they're operating under statutes and codes, then they don't have jurisdiction. So generally speaking, pretty much most of these cases, you know, the family courts, they have a problem. You can challenge the jurisdiction in there. Also, they have due process problems. So those are the two issues, due process, you're not getting it, and also jurisdiction, they don't have it. So that's the very first thing people need to do is to challenge that. Now, we wrote a paper, a generic paper that can be used by anyone to challenge jurisdiction. And you can find that, let me see, if you go up, we put a new link up on our website under the blue, on the blue bar, you'll find due process. And if you click on that link, the due process, you need to read through these things, but you will find in here that we do have instructions on how to challenge jurisdiction. We also have other things, which I'll quickly go through some of these other items, and then we'll talk a little bit about jurisdiction and people who might call in concerning cases that they have and how they may proceed to get out of these courts where they're really, you know, abusing the people. But anyway, we do have the access to National Liberty Alliance's consent of government course on this page. And this page, you know, really access to all of this information requires people, first of all, to be a member. So you won't be able to really go any further than this page unless you become a member. Also, you know, we've been trying to raise money for quite some time. We ask for people, you know, to give donations. We give everything away for free. Even our government by consent course, you know, to some degree, that's free too, because if people can't afford it, we'll give it to them for free. And maybe one day they can afford to give us something and that'd be fine. But if not, some people are on limited incomes, and we want to make sure that everybody gets this knowledge, so we don't want to refuse anyone. Certainly we hope that people don't abuse that, because if they can afford $5, what's $5? $5 is a month is $60 a year. So, I mean, most people can afford $60 a year. $5 a month is a cup of coffee and a roll of butter and maybe a donut. Okay. So you give that up once a month. And therein is $5. I think that the work we're doing here, the information we have, the courses we have, and a lot of things which we're going to discuss in a few minutes that we have up on online, is well worth $5 a month. And we should hope that people would continue with us as years go by, because we have a lot of work to do. Not only do we have to get justice back into our courts, we also have to fix the political process and get rid of all these political animals and start electing statesmen and require only statesmen to, you know, be able to be put onto the ballots. And that's and we'll be teaching people how we can send to our government through this process called the committee man. But that's a little future. First, we need to deal with the with what's going on in the court systems. And so consent of government is the most important thing. We need to consent to our political political system and the people that are elected there. We have the power to recall. We have the power to indict someone out of office if it's necessary. Of course, they have to commit a crime for that. And that's easy to find the most of these people in office these days anyway. Hopefully, once the law is reestablished and justice is established back in the courts and they realize it, I think hopefully they'll behave. But you'll always get that person who won't, and we'll have to deal with them. But also, you know, through the, so that you, we can indict them through the judicial process, through dealing with the grand juries. Or we can remove these people within 90 days by recall. We can recall anyone. And even the President of the United States can be recalled. But what is required, well, that may not be true. And I got to think that out a little more, because really the President is elected by the states. But Maybe it is possible, because there's a certain percentage of whatever votes went out. You'd have to get so many signatures, a certain percentage of signatures of that which is voted in the last election. I don't remember what that is. Each state may be a little different, but they're probably pretty much on the same line of percentages. So if the committeemen of each state went to get do a recall within their state and was able to get the enough signatures, and then you were able to do that in every state of the union, and I would imagine you'd have to have every state. You couldn't skip one, I think, anyway. I'm really not too sure about this, but as far as the president is concerned. So in theory, I guess you could remove the president. But no doubt anybody else in office, Congress, senators are supposed to be put into position and power by the state legislatures. The 17th Amendment destroyed that balance of power in the Constitution. We intend on fixing that. And it's one of the things we plan on doing as we go through this process. So the senators, we the people, really should not be voting for. But anyone else, you're a congressman, we can remove them by recall. Certain percentage of whatever the votes were that put them in the caucus, we can recall them, pull them out, 90 days, run a new election, and replace that individual. And again, of course, as I mentioned before, there's always the option, the nuclear option, which would be really an indictment. But again, they'd have to be in criminal behavior for that. These are the things we're working on and we need to be doing and getting out there. And people need to understand this, and they need to be able to take control and have government by consent. And they can only do that, of course, if they're educated. So anyway, getting back to this page here now, we have, the access to government by consent course, in order to get through past this page to get all these items that I'm going to read off. You do need to be a supporting member, which means you'd be a member and giving us minimum $5 a month. That's $60 a year. We have the free access to the civics course. You only have to be a member to get to that one. I wrote a book a while back, and I've forgotten that I had even written this book. It's about 189 pages. And we did have it up on the website. I moved it in here to this part of the site where, again, in order to get a copy of this book, it's a PDF book, 186 or 189 pages, and it's court procedure book. And what it does is it lays out the process and the procedure, what forms do you have to do in order to file a paper in a court. Now, I did write this a few years back. It should be, and I breezed through it, it does look pretty good that it still stands. But there are some details, little things that, for instance, back then when I wrote this book, I didn't realize that the common law courts or the natural law courts were so hidden, and that when you open up a civil case, you're really opening up something that brings you into an equity court. Generally speaking, the court is guided by something. It could be a contract between two individuals where an argument comes in, and so on. But nevertheless, if you go to open a court, let's say, and you're going against an individual who's abusing their powers, and you file a case, you're filing it in a civil court, that's the only option you have. And that should not be. There should be a way to get into a court of law, making it clear this is a court of record. I'm coming in here under a court of record, and we don't want any judges making any decisions here, except for obvious decisions where the only summary decision could possibly be made is if a couple of things. Number one, if there's a default, and generally the judge doesn't even make that decision. The individual writes an affidavit of default and files it with the clerk, and that's it, case is done, over, finished. There is a secondary thing. If the case is so overwhelming towards one side, you could get a summary judgment because it's so powerful. The other side, I guess, could try to make an argument, and that could force that into, I presume, I'm not sure on this, but I think it could probably force it into the courts to be heard, and the jury would have to make the decision. But if a case is that overwhelming, the case should go rather quickly, I would imagine, in any event. We do have a book up there, Court Procedure Book. lays out exactly everything required, the different forms to file a case, how to make a motion. It talks about the headings and the footing and the body and the breakdowns of different things that in order to write a paper. And also we have some examples. Our examples mostly are found under the grand jury, I think. I think it's under the grand jury tab, where we have filed cases in the past. So there's, you get some examples of writing there. Also, we have other things. We have instructions and forms to challenge jurisdiction, which starts off with, first of all, a notice of motion that you're challenging the jurisdiction. We give instructions there. There's about six different forms that are needed, or maybe five, plus the instruction page. And if you follow the instruction, it's pretty simple. It's got blanks. Fill in your name and address and this different things here or there. But basically, the language stays the same. It's really generic. If you're challenging jurisdiction, you're challenging jurisdiction. Now, there's a process, first of all. Again, you have to give a notice, and that notice has to be given, of course, to the prosecutor, and you have to file one with the court. So you have to give a notice of motion with the paper challenging the jurisdiction. And it should be that challenge of jurisdiction is a sworn statement, so that's an affidavit. That particular paper is an affidavit and the action or the move towards challenging that jurisdiction, so it's just one form. If they do not respond in 30 days, because the court that you're probably in, depending on what court you're in, let's say if you're in a village court, a town court, a city court, if you're in some city courts or courts of record, though you have to look in your constitution. In New York State, New York City courts or courts of record. But in any event, these other courts are administrative courts. They do not have the power to fine or incarcerate. They're administrative. And they sometimes call themselves criminal courts, and they act on criminal basis, whether they have one judge make a decision, often making summary judgments on individuals and sending them to jail up to a year. There are no indictments often in these things. And sometimes they'll give you a jury. They'll give you maybe a six-person jury. But even the jury is tainted and tampered with. It follows statutes and codes. All of that is unlawful. It is not a court of record. So that's why we challenge these things. And we can challenge, and again, it's generic. It's always the same thing. There's nothing special here. Now, we lay this out very clearly. Number one, one of the mistakes we used to make is, I remember one time we went to court back and forth with an individual for about a year, back and forth, constantly back and forth, kind of like Crystal's been going back and forth for years into this one court. We should never allow a court to abuse us any more than once. Immediately challenge the jurisdiction and get it done with. They can't prove jurisdiction. Let's say they turn around and you're called into the court. You've already challenged jurisdiction. Prosecutor hasn't responded in paper, and you tell the judge, "Hey, you can't go forward because you don't have jurisdiction. I challenged it," and you say, "Oh yeah, well I decided it, so we're going to go forward." Well, that's a conflict of interest. First of all, he's biased. He already believes that he's got the authority and the jurisdiction. And so you have to challenge that. You have to object to that. If it goes that route, then you have no choice but to move it into the federal court for cause. I wouldn't even bother going up the state level. But in the paper, we make it clear, number one, the court that's being challenged can't make the ruling. It has to be made by a court of record. So they have to go up the line to the first court of record, which would probably be the county court or the state court. And so it's moved there. Papers have to go back and forth. Again, if they don't respond, you can default them. Your challenge in jurisdiction must be decided. The state court must rule on your behalf because they don't have jurisdiction. It is clear. Our paperwork is clear. If you read through it, you'll see they don't have that jurisdiction. So if they deny it and says, "Nah, they got jurisdiction," send you back down, then you have to move it into federal court for cause for denying of due process, also that you've challenged the jurisdiction. They didn't give it to you, therefore, and you didn't get your proper due process. They violated your unalienable rights, and at this point, you're not only going to sue for the court to cease and desist, you're going to probably sue for some damages for violating your unalienable right of due process. Maybe you'll say that's worth $10,000 or $20,000. People have to decide what that's worth, but we can't get ridiculous. It's not $1 million. And so this is one way to deal with the courts. Now, if should that fail, okay, there's always the option of moving your case in with our case. And you'll find on here a link which people will be able to click on and fill out a form, and they can move their case to our case. We would suggest, and we'll discuss that for anybody who wants to file their cases in with our case, move it into our case. We will suggest that anyone that wants to do that should also go through the process of denying jurisdiction and challenging it. Not necessarily up to the federal level, because that's where we're at. We'll be taking this into the federal level, but only up to the state level if they'll give it to you. If not, then there's a petition that we've drawn up. You only have to fill in a little few pieces of information. Actually, we'll fill in that information. It's very minimum. On the petition, get it back to you. You would sign it and notarize it and mail it back to us. And then we would include your case with the challenge of jurisdiction, which they would deny or were not here, and that would make your case stronger. So that is another option or availability to anyone that is a member. All of these things require people to be a member. Now, we've had a lot of people with us have court problems. You know, we've had problems in the courts with the cases and so on and so forth, and we've talked about it, and we tried people, help people with habeas corpuses, and when they came after people with non-judicial foreclosures, give people information on challenging jurisdiction and other ideas on what they may be able to do, in order to take control of their case. A lot of these people are members, and they stick with us, and they come to the meetings from time to time, or maybe often, and so on and so forth. But then we do have people that come in, and they're only interested in their cases, and once they get whatever they can from us, we don't hear or see from them again. We will do everything we can to help people, but that also requires a return. If we're going to help you, you have to help others. You know, we freely have been given the knowledge that we have, and so we've received it freely, and therefore we're required to give it freely. Of course, we need the money to support what we're doing, so we're asking for a minimum donation. Now, if people aren't willing to support us, then that's fine. Then we can't help them. We can give them a few ideas, but they won't be able to get to our paperwork or do anything unless they become a supporting member. Now, I have kind of fought this idea of sealing off a page or a place where we would require people to be paid members. But we've tried over the years, many years now, and we're just kind of basically there. You know, I mean, we're not really making enough to do as much as we can do. I mean, there's a lot of things we could do. We do have some people that are very generous and have helped us with large donation here and there that has really picked us back up and gets us out of debt, and eventually we fall back into it and again get up. We also have an individual recently who's given a large sum on a monthly basis, and that's going to be a really, really big help to us. We got over 7,000 members. If 3,000 of those 7,000 members were to give $5 a month, that's $15,000 a month. That's a lot of money. Imagine what we could do with $15,000 a month. We'd actually get a few paid positions here, because we do need full-time people. And people, you know, can't work for nothing. We all volunteer our time as much as we can. Those of us who are retired don't really care much if we get much money here or there, as long as we have enough to live on. So we do what we have to do. But we do need some people who have some skills that we need to be able to hire, and then be able to require them to have a certain production of whatever it is that they need to do, particularly with paperwork. So that would be really nice if we can get a couple of people on the payroll and get that done, going that way. But meanwhile, till that happens, we're still just volunteers and working our way. to the best we can. So we will have instructions and forms to challenge jurisdiction. We will have instructions and forms to move your case to the federal court for cause, step by step, complete the generic, very minimal information to put in there. Any place you see red, you have to fill your personal information in. And then turn to black, of course, like your name, the date, the address, the name of the court, the names of the individuals involved, so on and so forth. I've done some research on habeas corpus a little further than what we already had, and I found some language that is pretty darn strong. When an individual requests, so we're going to move habeas corpus in a different way. Anybody who wants to do a habeas corpus, so all they have to do is become a supporting member. They can get into this page and go to the instruction and the forms to file a habeas corpus. If anybody has questions on this information, you know, they can come on a Monday night program and ask us, you know, I didn't understand this, or how can I do that, and not sure what to do here. And we can kind of fill in those gaps, okay? But all of there's instructions there. There's all the forms and everything you need to file it. And I found some very, very strong language where when a person files for habeas corpus, and this is the way it should be, of course, this is the law, but there's been some codified laws that are very strong that claims and says, and you can use this on the judge, he must hear it. He must decide it. He can't ignore it. He can't deny it. They cannot deny a habeas corpus. Now, they have set things up where they want you to petition for a habeas corpus. And when you petition for that habeas corpus, then, of course, they can decide whether they want to get it or not. I'm not sure exactly how we're going to write this up yet. We may have to write it in a petition form, but the petition form is going to be very clear that, hey, judge, you don't have any decision-making on whether you're going to give it to us or not, unless the case is so, unintelligible or something that you can't make head or tails of it, then, of course, you know, but you need to tell a person, go back and fix it, not that you can't have it, okay? But anyway, people who file habeas corpuses, if they're not heard and it doesn't go through, you have the option to attach that habeas corpus to our case. So all you have to do is give us a call, go through the process. Now, we are charging, and I don't really want to charge, and we're asking for a donation of $50 for anyone who wants to attach their case, and that covers our costs, printing and mailing, and helps cover a lot of other costs also. But again, like anything else we do, anybody who is on a very stringent, income, minimum amount or whatever, and they can't afford this, maybe they can afford $5. Well, that $5 donation will be fine. You know, and we're not requiring a $50 donation, but most people, if they have a case, they should be able to pay that $50 to donate. Again, this is not for paying us to do anything. It's donating so that we can cover the cost to do these things. The donation goes to National Liberty Alliance. National Liberty Alliance supports all of the costs that the grand jury has to incur. Of course, plus some of that money goes to support what we're doing here with National Liberty Alliance. It also helps to support the people who can't afford. It helps to support the cost of putting that paperwork together for them and so on and so forth. Now, anybody who we have done a habeas corpus for, or anyone that we have done a non-judicial foreclosure for, will need maybe some paperwork done, but there is no required donation beyond what you've already given us. So we will be moving all of those into our court with our case. The other thing is we have come together as a grand jury a while back and made a decision that all these judges that have denied people's right of due process and taken their homes away from them, people who have habeas corpuses and they were not heard, we have decided to indict all those judges. We have not done that filing yet, but that also will be filed with this case at that time, all of the indictments of all of the judges that have just ignored people's due process and have decided to just do whatever it is they want to do. So again, all of that will be coming in, and we will not be asking for any additional donations for those individuals we've been working on. We also have some other information up on our page. We have Black's Law Dictionary. I believe, well, we got about two editions. We got the second edition and the fourth edition. We also have Bouvier's Law Dictionary. Also, people can download them in PDF. We have a copy of the Federal Civil Procedures. That's the rules. It's about 100 and I'm surprised to see it was so many pages. I think it was about 150 pages to do just those civil rules. Now, we should understand those rules. They don't generally apply to us, okay, but we should understand them, and we should be able to use them and be able to respond to you know, any argument concerning their rules. We'll use whatever rules we can that make sense. You know, let's take, for instance, you know, they have rules for for serving. And they have a way you can serve them different ways. You could do it through the mail, and you have to have an affidavit of service. Someone has to do it for you. That's not part of the case. You could pay a server to do it. You could pay the sheriff to do it, and so on. But you, if it's your case, you can't serve it. You have to get an outsider, and you got to get someone to do an affidavit of service on that. Well, that rolls over into natural law also. You're going to serve something on someone, and you're going to go into a court of record, and you're suing someone or something, it stands to reason that you want to notify them, and you want to do it in a way, and the way they have set up works for us. Why not? So we can use some of their rules. We can also deny some of their rules. Under Rule 12, they love to throw us out. We can deny that. Let's see what else we have. We also have a Maxims of Law from Bouvier's, 1856. It's a law dictionary. It's called The Lawful Path. But it's Maxims of Law. Again, it's a good book to go through, and maybe you can use some of these things in your cases. We also have a book written by Sir Edward Coke. We're also including here also our Memorandums of Law, which we have about 24 or so of them printed up there. Memorandums of Law can also still be found under the grand jury under our judicial case, but we also have it listed here. We also have in here the instructions on how to join your case to the grand jury's action against the judiciary. And again, it's a very simple, and we also have more information, more things. So in order to get access to this list, you have to come to the bottom of the page and click here to enter. And if you're not a paid member, then again, you know, a supporting member, donating member, then you have to make sure you're a member and set up a donation of $5 a month or more. Again, it's only $60 a year. I'm sure most of the people can afford that. But the amount of information you get, you'll literally get in the course. The course, again, this book I wrote, there's a lot of details, okay? So, again, we have instructions and forms of challenging jurisdictions, instructions and forms to move your case for cause, instructions and form to file a habeas corpus. So as we start our program tonight and we take questions and people come up and get into the queue, and by the way, anybody wants to get into the queue, star 6, and I think a 1, star 6. Last time I looked, there was only one person in there. Well, there's two people in there now. So there's not that many people. You want to get into the queue, star 6 and a 1. So what I'm going to do, when people have a situation, we're going to suggest to do certain things. We're going to refer them to our paperwork. They'll need to go and work through the paperwork, read the instructions. If they have any questions or problems with it, they can come ask us. We'll give them a general response without spending a lot of time just kind of, you know, covering the problem, which really is jurisdiction and due process. But we're not going to get into discussing cases and getting too deep into cases. We'll give them information, we'll help as best we can. And we should be able to do that within just a few minutes, maybe 5 minutes of our time or whatever. And the reason why we're doing this or going to be doing this is because, you know, really this Q&A session, when we get over to Q&A, we want people to be asking questions. You know, we have subjects that we cover every Monday. Tonight's subject was Article 3 Courts. Also, Brent usually comes up with a subject and whatever that subject matter may be. Also, maybe people have questions about what we're doing, where we're going here at National Liberty Alliance, how things work with the grand jury. We want those kind of questions. We want to really people to ask questions and get involved with, what we're doing, to understand what we're doing. But we also want people to look, if you're going to come here for help, we're going to give it to you. But there's others that need help too. You need to get behind us and work with us to help others also. We need the support at a certain time where we need everyone to stand up, and that time is coming soon. I keep watching the news, and I get very nervous of the fact that we're falling behind, that we're not coming in on time. But I am doing everything I can to accomplish the work I have to accomplish, and a lot of people that are working together with us is doing the same thing, putting as much time as they can in to accomplish the things we need to accomplish. At some point, we'll be ready to file the papers. I'm still seeing us a month away. I don't get the amount of time that I'd like to put on the case because there's so many other things going on. I have to put time into the course. I have to put time into the book. I have to put time into creating pages and doing different things, putting what we put together here, writing these papers in order to, kind of forms for papers to be for people to use these papers and to file. To challenge a jurisdiction or move their case or whatever to a habeas corpus and so on. But anyway, generally speaking, I feel we're going to be ready just in time. Okay, I think arrests are going to start, this is May, Mayday, Mayday. There was a focus of this time period by Q for quite some time. This is the time. So I think we're going to see arrests starting this month, and they're going to go through. It's going to hit I think in a month or two, it's going to be really hitting hard. And that's going to be the perfect timing for us to file our papers to do what we're doing. Because you'll be coming in with the right punch. We'll be coming in with the left punch, so to speak. Because, once they finally get the memo, and I'm talking about these judges, that they no longer have protection from the deep state and, that now they're kind of on their own. Things are going to be a little different, and I think they're going to listen to us a little more, and I think they're going to think a little more before they act or say anything. So everything is coming to a head. I think timing is perfect. We didn't plan it this way. We didn't know how long it would take to get to where we are at this moment. But here we are at the right time, a month away, potentially speaking, for what President Trump is doing and others and what we're doing. So this is the time, and we need everyone really kind of on deck. Again, everybody should be financially supporting us. Everybody needs to be educating themselves. Don't think you're going to, get your liberty and be able to do anything for yourself if you don't understand common law, and if you don't understand our Constitution, if you're ignorant, you don't have the power and the authority. You have the authority, but you don't even know you have the authority. But you certainly don't have the power to be able to do anything. Knowledge is power. So we give all these things. Again, all these things are available under due process. So with that, I'm trying to think if I missed anything. Jan, do you think I missed anything on that? Is there anything I need to...
Not unless you wanted to talk about our meeting Wednesday night and the importance of coming to it.
Okay, yes. So Wednesday night, we are getting together for those who want to join within our in our case. And the only subject we'll be discussing is the joinder in order to join our case. So people can come and ask questions, and we'll talk a few little things about it. Anybody who wants to join should get out here right now and get that that page paper filled out. Let's see, it's instructions to move your case for cause. If you click on that, it's a one pager. It gives you instructions, and there's a very short list of questions on the bottom. You basically need name, address, name of the court, and a few other things. But it's not much. And then we will fill the form out for you, and then we'll instruct you on what you need to do as we go forward. This is going to become a partnership. We're not going to handle all the paperwork. We're going to handle most of the important paperwork to make sure it gets filed right. But ultimately, we're going to count on the individual to file the papers. instead of us having to, you know, print out all the papers and put them together and then file them and serve them on every individual involved, plus the court, plus the individual whose paperwork we worked with, we're going to do it a little different. We're going to prepare all the paperwork where we will give it to the individual. They will download it. We'll do it all, you know, over the Internet, PDF it, and when they get it, they just need to print it out. It'll be in proper order as it should be put together. It'll be all in proper order. And then it'll be the individual's duty to then make sure the individuals involved is served. In most cases, it's the prosecutor and the court, you know, the judge. Prosecutor, judge, and the court. Three servings plus one for yourself, so you make four copies. And then you file the three, and then you do an affidavit of service. You make sure you get someone that is not part of the case that does the affidavit of service for you. Again, any questions on any of these details? Those are things, once we're moving and people have, you can ask on Monday night programs. And if people are here on Monday night programs, if everyone's here on Monday night programs, eventually they'll hear all the things necessary and they'll keep up to date on the things they need to know. And we shouldn't have to answer the same questions over and over and over and over again. Occasionally, of course, we understand we need to, but generally speaking. But again, this next meeting, which is Wednesday, what is it, 8 o'clock, Jan? I think I wrote that down, 8 o'clock. That's what it looks like. 8 p.m. Eastern Standard
right, it's
Time.
It's 8 o'clock, yep.
Okay, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time right here in this room. Anybody who wants to join their case in, anybody who has a habeas corpus that we've done for them, again, we're not going to ask for any additional donations. You've already donated, so we're going to add your case in. But we're going to need, you know, some a small piece, you know, a small form to be filled out in order to join that case in with ours. And it's really a petition for us to the grand jury to join, to do a joinder. Same thing with the non-judicial foreclosures. Anybody we've helped with non-judicial foreclosures. And bear in mind, let me in my research, we've got a lot of these put together. You'll find them. I'm trying to think on some of this paper, for instance. Let me see which one. Okay, I forget exactly which one. Well, wait a second. No, that's not it. Anyway, look, we have found that once jurisdiction is challenged, it must be decided. We already said that. Jurisdiction can be challenged at any time. Any time. You could be in the middle of the case and have an epiphany and say, wait, I don't think this court has jurisdiction. At that point, everything has to, if you challenge the jurisdiction, make a motion to challenge jurisdiction, everything stops. And anything that they've accomplished or did or charged you with or anything prior, you know, and if they don't have jurisdiction, becomes null. It's meaningless. Even after the case is done, if you realize that at some point you have been defrauded and you have been a court that didn't have jurisdiction, and the Supreme Court has said numerous times that if the court does not have jurisdiction, all its decisions are null and void, meaningless. It's if they ever never even happened. So, if you've lost your home, you know, through non-judicial foreclosures, if people are still in jail because the habeas corpus is, and even if they've gotten out because they served time, but the habeas corpus was never applied, maybe we can do something with that. I don't know. But definitely, if people are still in jail, we want to try to work with them to get them out. So at any time, jurisdiction will be challenged, even after the case is done. And if they didn't have jurisdiction, all their decision is null and void, irrelevant, that's gone. It's like it never happened. So, look, at knowledge is power. It's everything. People need to get it. We need to do that. Okay. All right. If anybody's, hopefully you're looking at these pages. We have other things. I have put up here also downloaded. You can download by footnotes. I've got about between 400 to 500 footnotes. Okay, and even within each one of those footnotes, there are different categories or different, I don't know how you say this, well, just different things sometimes, but it's under one heading. And so when I started to write footnotes, I started to get little notepads. I'd get, open up a notepad, and I'd put the necessary cases or any proof or sources that I'd want to use on a particular word or a phrase, and that would be my footnotes. And I've got, like I said, about between 400 to 500 of them. And every once in a while, I come to a point where I need a footnote on something that I haven't done yet. But that's not too often anymore. I've pretty much covered a lot, at least what we've been doing. I've got footnotes on pretty much everything we've been doing. So I don't think there's much, at least for me, to have to add to that. But again, that's available to people. It's a very valuable, valuable tool. Okay, so access to all those footnotes. We also have a list of landmark Supreme Court cases. We have this listed other places on our website also, but I wanted to put it in here because I will tell you that anybody who comes into this page and works through all these things and comes to an understanding of these things, and particularly, you know, the booklet that we give that people can get, what's it called, the court procedure book, okay, 180-some-odd pages of procedure, how it works, how court papers flow. It's the anatomy of a court case is what it is. As a matter of fact, I believe that's what I called it, the anatomy of a court case. So you go through all this and take our courses, and if you're really diligent and taking your time and really making sure you understand everything, because that's the key to knowledge is understanding. I have this thing I've come to realize some years back. If you understand it, you'll never forget it. And that has been true to me, and I think anybody that knows that it realizes how true that statement is. Fill your time up with a certain subject matter, and you can become expert at it. Anybody can do that. It's just a matter of putting the time in. You got to research. You got to read. You got to study. You know, reading and researching is studying, you know, and that could be fun, especially with this particular subject matter, because liberty is invigorating. It's exciting. It's fun. So anyway, we have that here. These memorandums that I've written, okay, and like I said, we've got about 20 some odd of them. We've got another maybe 15 or 20 more to come, maybe about 40 of them. They also are listed on this page, even though you can get it on other pages on our website. I wanted, again, bring this together. Why? Because each one of these memorandums give you knowledge, okay? For instance, natural versus civil rights. USC 18, Title 18 is not law. Tax courts, statutes, codes, regulations, sovereignty, nonjudicial foreclosures, law and equity, jury nullification, jury tampering and stacking, high treason, habeas corpus, grand jury, all of these subjects, pages and pages of information, making it absolutely clear the power and the authority of the people to exercise these things and to use them to control our government and to prevent these people from injuring us. But again, if you don't have this knowledge and you don't know these things, well, then you're going to get beat up. And don't wait till it happens. Maybe there are people, I'm sure there's a lot of people that haven't been caught into the courts yet. Well, that doesn't mean you're not going to. In any event, everyone should be able to walk into a court and take care of business. We do need lawyers, and I like to say not bar taught, but we do need lawyers. We do need people who are experts in the titles, the USC titles, and, of course, people who can give advice and counsel to individuals in courts of law and maybe even articulate their case for an individual if they're unable to do so themselves and so on. So, again, we got so much stuff here, and we'll be adding more stuff in here, but, again, I promise you, if you go through all these things and take our two courses, the civics course and the government by consent course, you take those two courses, you go through this book I wrote, a court procedure book, and you look through all these things and start reading through these things and looking at instructions to do different things, I promise you, you'll be far more equipped and far more have ability and far more knowledge than most lawyers. I'd like to say any lawyers, but there are a few lawyers who understand the truth. And if they don't understand the truth, they're behind the eight ball because you can kick their rear ends in pretty bad. The judge has a big problem trying to, you know, maintain the status quo when we come in pro per into their courts and start exercising our unalienable rights and quoting the Constitution, United States Supreme Court, Founding Fathers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They don't even know what to do with this. They never even heard it. And so this is a real education in law. And I promise you, this is not difficult stuff. This is not boring stuff. It will not bore you to tears. Okay, let me move on from there. I spent a lot of time on that, but my point is I wanted to make this clear, and we can refer back to this this particular meeting tonight. I want to make it crystal clear that we can't spend a lot of time on a case. And we definitely never have to get into the details because, again, why fog up the court? The question is, do you want to win or do you want to fight? If you want to fight, then forget about what we're telling. Go try to win your case by fighting. You won't get anywhere anyway with it. But if you want to win, challenge the jurisdiction and move your case if necessary for cause because they're not giving you due process. Have that court case shut down, and you don't have to deal with the details of that court case. They don't have jurisdiction, you don't have to answer anything. You're out of there. You're done. And believe me, the other courts, the higher courts, that really the state courts and the county courts, generally speaking, can't speak for this in a lot of states because I've heard some stories of county courts handling some of these traffic things. But maybe they have a different prosecutor. Maybe they kind of put on a different hat or something. We have a county prosecutor here in my county, but we also have a town prosecutor who is hired up for the sole purpose of hearing traffic cases and other miscellaneous court cases that they have no power or authority to run. So again, win the war, win the battle, deny them access, deny them their jurisdiction. They ain't got it, deny it. Challenge it. And also move it to federal court if they pursue you and push you to the point where they're violating your due process, and then look for damages. And I'll tell you what, I've always been merciful in my moving that way. When you get to what needs to be done, forget about the money. I'm as long as the court case is down, I'm out of there. But in these cases, as you win, pursue the money also. Make them pain a little bit because, look, they've damaged you. Even if you say, well, you injured me and it's $5,000 for violating my right of due process or $10,000, you should do that. I would if you have to go as far as into the federal courts for it. That's my rule of thumb at this point myself. Okay, let's see where we're at. Jan, do we have any announcements?
We have Gary Will, who has a brief report on the Welcome Committee, and I have about 20-some questions for tonight.
Okay. Let's take the questions. Let's get Gary out there first, and we'll take the questions. We'll try to go through them quick. If it takes a little too long, we may have to put some of them off for next week, but we'll see.
Yep. Is he muted?
Gary, where you at? Jump
I'm
into
right
the...
here.
Oh, you found him? Oh, I see him right there, yeah.
Okay, you unmuted, Gary?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, John, we still need help in on the Welcome Committee, and I need some help, too. We're kind of revising the foundational study, and if I need some people to help out in that effort, if I could get a few people to do that. I'd like them to have a little history, a little idea of our history and so on. I think that'd be a big plus, but I think that anyone that could help out would be appreciated. And I'll let Ron tell you what he needs as far as the calling situation. So that's my request. Ron, are you there? Can you unmute Ron and let him briefly tell you what he needs and what states or time zones he needs people?
Jan, did you find Ron?
Hello? Anyway, there he is. Okay.
Go ahead, Ron.
John, can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay. All right. This is Ron, Arkansas. We have been keeping up pretty much with the calling of the new people. We're about 2 weeks behind right now, I think. I think we're up to the 2nd of May, so we're not too far behind, a few days. The next project phase we're going to go into is primarily to help in getting people who have finished the civics course into the new course and or finished both courses and get them into the new course. And I've been calling people of late in that endeavor, and I'm surprised to find that these people go through the entire civics course, and they have been in NLA for 3 or 4 years, and they've never been to a Monday night call. They're totally oblivious to it. Now, whether that they don't read the newsletter or what happened there, I don't know, but I've run across 2 or 3 people in that regard. So if they're not going to the Monday night call and they're not reading the weekly call, then they probably don't know about the new course. And so we have broken that up into 2 phases and into 4 time zones. And we have about 9 people addressing this, and we'll be starting that process this week. I'm working up the spreadsheets on that now. It's going to take us about a month to go through that. If we had another 9 people, we could do it in 2 weeks. And the quicker the better, because the quicker we can get them into those courses, the better off we'll be down the road. And also, we also need to address these people that came in to NLA and signed up to be grand jury administrator, but maybe there's a lot of people that came in that didn't know what that was and didn't want to necessarily check that box, but now after having taken the courses, maybe they now want to take that challenge and take up that position. So we'll be addressing that as well. Like I say, if there's some people out there that maybe the state coordinators want to get involved in this that aren't involved now and give a helping hand, we need people who are familiar with Excel spreadsheets and have a good phone that works well that you can call them back if they have to leave a message. So if we could get 9 more people, that would be great. We need a lot of people in the central time zone primarily. If you're in the time zone and it's 9:30 right now in your time zone and you can volunteer your help, that would be appreciated. You can reach me by email at ron@nationallibertyalliance.org. In the subject matter, just put welcome committee help or your name and county, and I'll be able to call you back or reach you. I'll be able to run you down and give you a jingle back, and we can get together. Again, you have to be familiar with Excel spreadsheets because that's what I'll be submitting to you, and you'll be calling approximately 5 to 6 people per week, which takes, I can call 15 people in an hour and a half because only a portion of those are going to be home. You might have to call them back at a different hour when they're not working or something like that. So in an hour and a half, you can reach 5 people, and the rest you'll be leaving messages for. Sometimes they'll call back, sometimes they don't. In this particular category, I found that the people that I did call back, because they've been through the civics course or because they've been through the Constitution or because they've been through the government by consent, they do call you back. I've had no exception to that. If never taken a course, the chances of them calling you back are remote unless they've joined fairly recently. And everybody, no exceptions, we're glad I made the call, and we're glad that I reached out to them. They like to hear from you. So it's a pleasant call to make. So if you get access to a phone, you want to get involved, help out, it's a good job, makes you feel good, makes them feel good, and everybody gets helped all along the way. So we need to populate this new course.
Ron, when make your calls, do you use Skype, and do you have a recorder?
No, I don't use Skype. I just use a line.
Do you have a way to record the conversation when you're having with somebody?
I've never used the recorder, no.
Let's try to see if you can find something. Maybe Jan might know or someone else. I mean, Skype works well with me. I have a recorder with my Skype, and so all my calls are recorded. And that's good, because if you go back and re-listen, get information, you know, that was a lot or whatever. But look at, if you get a few good calls and you get them recorded, you can use them as examples for people that you're training to see how a call might go, you know, how the conversation might go. And once someone listens to two or three calls, they'll pick it up themselves, because it's really a conversation about what we're doing. And you'll hit your own little tweaks and different thoughts and things in there, in that conversation. So, and the conversation will drive itself. The key thing is really getting the people to make sure they understand what we're doing and what we have available here, the knowledge and the fact that they need that knowledge. But go ahead, finish up, Ron. I'm sorry.
That's all right. No, I was pretty much finished up. Like I said, we got about 9 people. We could use 2 more in each time zone for 8 more people. Then we could get this knocked out that much quicker. And we'd be back on schedule. So,
I'd like to make a comment too, John. That's a good idea, what you suggested. The other thing is, I noticed recently in going through the people that have enrolled in the government by consent course, only about 14% have gotten out of the into a chapter. So all the members registered in that course, only 14% have started chapter 1. And just registering doesn't help much. They need to...
Right. People need to move through it. Yeah.
I think the problem with that, John, was a delay in getting it off the ground, because when it was originally announced back in April and May last year, it was another 6 months before you actually kicked it off, and those people went back to sleeper, you know, came in one door and went out the other, so they're not around.
Yeah, that, and also we had quirks in the beginning where, you know, when someone would put all their answers in and then hit for check, they wouldn't know which ones were right and which ones were wrong, and they had to do it again, and it took us a while to fix that, so I know people must have got frustrated. So you might want to make that point up to people that when you call, if they had gotten into the course and started and they're not active in it, we fix that problem, because that was a frustrating problem, you know.
Right.
Now, you know, when you hit that button, your right answers stay there, and you'll see, well, this one, and this one was wrong, and then you can figure out the answer and then get it done and move on to the next chapter. So,
sure. Good point.
Okay, anything else for you guys?
No,
that's all I got.
Okay, Jen, we had a couple of women who were going to get together and form a committee. I forget what that committee was for. Has that been activated yet?
It is in the making stage. They're still working on a title and a couple of paragraphs on it. One of the people's in the number one in the queue right now. You can check with her when she comes on.
Well, once that committee gets up and going, maybe we can have a meeting. Gerard and myself can come into that meeting and see how things are going, and help spark it off and give a little support and see what thoughts and ideas we can give. Are there any other committees that want to make any announcements or anything? And again, any committee that we've got going, you take the opportunity every Monday, you know, to make an announcement. And even if you only spend 30 seconds on the mic saying, hey, everything's going good, we're doing this, that, the other thing, we can need more people, and just give a brief idea of what it is that you're doing, and that's it. Sometimes you might want to spend more than a few minutes, you know. Okay, if there's nothing else, so we're ready for some questions, and we'll take it from there.
Okay, first question. This person's son is incarcerated, been in jail for 15 years for a vehicular homicide and unintentional accident. We've been working to get him released all this time with no results. His health is failing fast, and I was wanting to know if you knew of any organizations that will help us, as he's getting no medical treatment in that warehouse. He has a lot of medical issues which are not being addressed. Please let me know, as this is getting urgent. I will be listening to your calls.
This was vehicular homicide?
Vehicular homicide, yes.
And obviously it was an accident, right?
Obviously what, John?
It was an accident. I mean,
yes,
they didn't
say
try to run someone down in the street or anything, you know?
Right. It was before the terrorists, yeah. It doesn't give any more information on it than that. It was unintentional accident.
That seems quite big. You know, 15 years in jail, you know, for that seems quite over, overkill, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Number one. The other thing is yeah, look at people go into jail and 90% of the people in jail need to be released. It's that simple. We need to get restitution to the people that they may have injured, if that is the case. A lot of people are in there because of bad behavior. They did things that the state was said bad behavior, which is none of their business. They need to be released. But those who are in there for a real reason, they need to really focus in on restitution, not to put these people in jail. That doesn't do anybody any good. And of course, we want these people to return back into society. It is a problem, and I don't have an answer for that at this point. And another problem they do have is they don't get the health care in prison that they should be getting. This is a horror story, just a horror story. And there's not going to be much we can do until we get to the other side of things. And I can assure you, look at, you know, we will be getting some rallying going between the grassroots people in each county that have taken the positions of administrators and really get some rallying going on trying to bring justice not only to our courts but to the whole system and try to come up with ideas and share them with each other on different experiences we have and what we did here, which was a good thing. You know, someone else can have another case come up and be aware of what the other group had done and say, hey, let's do that, you know, because we could solve problems and then share those problem solvers with each other across the nation right here through our meetings in National Liberty Alliance with the grand juries, you know, the administrators coming together. They should come together probably once a week, at least once a month, but I think once a week maybe. And, of course, on Mondays they can come in and ask questions if they get stuck. And we can assist them in any way we can. But we can't deal with that problem until really later. What else you got?
Okay, I have 3 to 5 claims that I may want to consider in a class action lawsuit. How many different claims can one file?
We're not doing a class action lawsuit.
Right, I think she's referring to the enjoinder.
Right. Come to Wednesday meeting. And we'll talk about it. What's next?
Okay. Can you explain?
Wednesday meeting is for the jointer. Anybody who wants to join their case with ours, that's what it's for. So come to the Wednesday night meeting, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, for anything on that. Good. Next.
Can you explain, if granted the class action status, what we can expect to happen with a case that was in the federal courts that has been dismissed with or without prejudice?
Justice.
Okay.
And again, it's not a class action. I hope people will stop calling it that. This is part. This is such an extraordinary, unique way of going. It's only been done once before, and we're doing it differently. They did it differently than the way we're doing it, but it has only been done once before, back in 1776. What's the next question?
I have a food safety whistleblower's claim that was denied, and now I am preparing an appeal. Will this type of claim be accepted in the class action case?
Well, I don't know what that is. We're going to put a committee together, and Jim will be going through the cases and anything that becomes questionable. You know, he'll bring it to my attention, or maybe we'll put a committee together to make decisions on cases. But I don't know yet until we understand more about that case. Look at one of the things we do want to do is we want to go after this would be Congress's job, really, I think, or maybe actually it's one of the federal agencies, the Food and Drug Administration. We have so much poison in our foods and our drinks and even in our water and in our air, and they're responsible for them. Heads got a role on this. And we do plan on doing something with that, but that's a little bit later on down the road. What's next?
I have an acquaintance that has been tried, convicted, and now imprisoned for violating a neighborhood or neighboring state's gun law. He infringed on no one's liberty, merely carried his firearm into a state that doesn't recognize his state's license to carry. Okay.
They should get together with us on Wednesday. Everyone who's doing a joinder, they need to do a challenge the jurisdiction. even if the case is over, if you've lost your home or lost you lost the case, if you went to jail for 6 years, you're out, maybe IRS case, you went to jail, you came out. Well, look at the, that's something. That, let me tell you, that's a lawsuit. People need to be restored. That's a million-dollar deal right there. I know if I had to go to jail for 6 years and I come out and then I was able to go back into the courts and sue, I'd be suing a minimum of $1 million, bare minimum. I'd go for a lot more than that. So anybody, even if you've lost the case, if they didn't have jurisdiction, they're not too late to challenge jurisdiction, have the whole thing overturned. We'll work something out with them. Come to the meeting on Wednesday. Next.
Well, a claim that was before an arbitrator be accepted in this suit?
Well, no. Once you did an arbitration, you've signed a paper, that's it, unless there was really a real misjustice within the arbitration. I don't know. Again, that's something you'd have to come, we'd have to look at that case, you know, specifically try to understand. But don't know. Probably not, but don't know. Possibility. I don't know what really took place, so. Next.
Okay. In preparing to file a fraud upon the courts while acting under the color of law claim against a federal court judge, attorneys, and clerks in their own individual personal capacity, can you explain why I should go forward with such or join the class action lawsuit?
We don't have a class action lawsuit.
Right.
Hopefully people are going to realize they got to stop calling it that. We have nothing to do with a class action lawsuit. Look, if you're looking for justice, that's where we're heading. We're putting all our cases together because it's all about not getting due process. It's all about them making decisions in jurisdictions unknown. They don't have the jurisdiction over us and so on. If they don't have jurisdiction, everything they've done is null and void. And they have to cease and desist if they're moving forward. So what was that question again? Because there was a little other part to that.
In preparing to file a fraud upon the courts while acting
okay.
under the color
yeah,
of law.
Fraud upon the court, you know, again, well, that's a case they'd have to pick up on their own to go for a lawsuit. They can do that. And if they need instructions and information on how to do that, and understand the procedures, they need to get involved and, you know, go out to our website and, you know, click on due process and get connected there and go through all that information and the book and everything, and that'll give you enough information to do what you want to do with that. But by joining with us, you know, we can potentially, again, we'd have to look at we'd have to know a little more about the case. That might have to be something we'd have to think about, but come to Wednesday's meeting. Next.
NLA is requesting the need of many becoming a committee man. Can you talk about briefly about the qualifications needed for that position? Is it a paid position?
No, it's not a paid position. It's probably about 40 hours a year, usually around election time. It's very rewarding because you actually get to talk to the people who want to run for office and make decisions on these people. You can look at if I probably will run for committee man again eventually. One of the questions, the first question I would ask anyone that wants to be interviewed for the sole purpose of running for a position is, have they taken any constitutional course? Tell me about the Constitution. And I'd ask them specific questions, and if they didn't have those answers and didn't know the Constitution, which they probably won't, then I'd send them to go take our course. When you finish with that, come back and we'll talk again. Because we need people who understand the Constitution, the authorities, and the powers that they're going to get, that they need not to abuse it nor to violate the Constitution or be brought out from under the chains of the Constitution. So, you know, that's for the committee man. Now, there was another part to that with the committee man. What was the – read that again.
Well, is it a paid position?
No, go ahead.
And, can you talk about briefly about the qualifications needed for that position?
Oh, the qualifications, yeah. The qualifications to become a committee man is you have to have a beating heart and live in some county in the United States. You got it. That's it. On some town, shall I say, or city or village or something.
Able to draw a breath, right?
But to become a committee man.
Okay, next question.
Mm-hmm.
Is NLA a not-for-profit educational organization? If not, why not?
Well, we've set things up as trust, and we don't get into the details.
Okay. If one donates $5 a month or a one-time $15,000 payment, will they get a receipt? Are these donations tax-deductible? And who, where, and how is NLA reporting the funds received?
No, we don't participate in giving receipts and get involved with tax deductions and all that other stuff. All that stuff is a whole different matter than what we're involved with. This is
okay.
The people's business. You know, the bottom line on what we're doing right now, the government should be paying us for doing this, because this is, right now, other people are doing this. They're called judges and prosecutors, U.S. attorneys, and they're doing it, and they're doing a horrible job, and they're committing all kinds of crimes. So we should be doing that. And at some point, we will work all that out.
Okay. Is NLA not interested in setting up a GoFundMe page?
Well, we did do a GoFundMe page. We did get a couple of $1,000, and it was a while back. I said it's hard to, you know, most of the money we collected, I don't think it was a couple of thousand, maybe about $1,500. But most of the money we did collect from that came from our own members going over there. We sent people over there. Very few people gave to us that, just found us out there. So there must be some tricks in trying to get your particular GoFundMe page to the top or to the front so that people will see it. I don't know what that may be. If anybody has that knowledge, maybe we can talk about it and try it again. What's next?
Will the county grand jury administrators replace the current grand jury positions?
Well, absolutely. If you're going to have a grand jury, then it's got to be free and independent. And it's never going to be free and independent as long as they're under the thumb of a prosecutor or a judge. It's never going to happen. And, you know, you have to have access to that grand jury. We have to have people advising the grand jury that's not lawyers. You know, not that they're not lawyers, but they're not bar lawyers. They're not, minions of the New World Order, shall I say. We need people who are properly educated, as Jefferson spoke. And properly educated means properly educated in the Constitution, ultimately, and the understanding of common law, okay? That's a proper education. Lawyers that have been running this are not. Also, they have blocked people from coming in to see the grand jury. Anybody should be able to go and see their grand jury. Anybody. But nobody can see the grand jury. They'll put you in jail if you try too hard to see the grand jury. And we know we've had people who've been put in jail. They said that they were stalking the grand jury. But the prosecutor did everything they could to prevent that person. He even sat outside the grand jury room trying to get in, waiting and getting on the list. And eventually they prosecuted this guy. He did 2 years in jail.
Okay.
So, next.
What is the determining factor as it relates to the rate of pay for one to start at $45,000 versus one starting at $60,000 for the grand jury administrator position?
Yeah, grand jury administrator really has a lot to do with knowledge and abilities, and we've listed that out in the questionnaire. When you decide to become an administrator, there's questions, okay? Do you have understanding of law, the court procedure and process? How much experience? Are you a speaker? Can you articulate well? We have a series of questions, and there's sort of a grade for each one of those questions as far as how many years of experience, and that really works out an idea of what the knowledge of the individual is so that they would be paid for their knowledge to some degree.
Okay, who will determine who will be selected for the grand jury administrator positions?
First come, first serve.
Okay, what are the job descriptions, duties, and what types of cases will be before the grand jury?
All criminal cases will go before the grand jury, and we've got a book partially written. It will become part of the course, probably. It definitely will become part of the book, so we will have a handbook for the administrators, and we'll go through all of that. People becoming administrators have to take all of the courses we put together here. They have to really become reasonably fluent. And it's just a matter of spending time with these things, reading these things, and understanding them. But then there'll be a handbook. And when someone runs into a blank and they're not sure, and the four together, you know, because each group, there'll be four administrators in each county minimum. And between the four of them, if they can't figure something out, you know, they can call their sister county, you know, other administrators to see what they've done. They can come to the Monday night program and ask questions and get some ideas. We'll assist them in any way we can with the necessary knowledge to achieve the goals that they're looking to achieve in their county for whatever case or situation it is. Next.
If the sheriffs ignored NLA's emails that were sent, what does NLA expect to happen if they mail the handbooks to the sheriffs and deputies at an estimated cost of approximately $80,000?
Right. Well, that is kind of a problem with them not listening and paying attention. But if you get a book, you know, look, people have this idea, if it's in a book, it must be true. You know, it's not necessarily true, but we'll run with that. Most people say it's in a book, it's written. Hey, there it is, you know. So if you get a nice printed out book and you pass it to the sheriff and you pass out 20 to each sheriff and so on, that would be good. We're also going to try to get another different kind of a campaign going for the president, for the sheriff maybe, which we'll discuss at a later time. But look, at the key is this. Once we're in the courts, okay, and we have the power and the authority, then getting a hold of the sheriff is pretty simple with a phone call and say, hey, you know, we're the administrators for the grand jury. We'd like to talk with you. Can you meet with us maybe on Wednesday at 9 or at 1 would maybe be better for you. You know, you get that sheriff down there, he's not going to deny coming in talking to them. He's going to be seeing the seat of authority, and that would be a good place to be able to pass them the information and the things about the law. But things have got to change, and sheriffs have got to become educated. And if they don't want to become educated, they need to leave office. If they don't leave office, we'll remove them. Two ways you can remove them. The grand jury administrator should be working very closely with the committeemen. There should be a very strong relationship between the two because they work together for consent of government. It's the people, uncontrolled by any political individual or groups or organizations. It's just totally free. And so they can remove the sheriff, you know, if he doesn't want to go and take his courses and learn the Constitution, he needs to leave his office. You can recall him. We can recall him. Probably the best way to go is to recall the sheriff. Have another election.
Okay. Is it our job, we the people, to fund the education of the sheriffs and deputies with the handbooks that are available to them free online? And who and how much will it cost to monitor such a project?
Well, again, you know, it all depends on getting into the courts. Once we're into the courts, that's when we can really leverage this stuff. If we start to get some good monies coming in, then we're going to go forward with the sheriff's handbooks. We're going to send 20 to each. But again, you know, they may come. It takes a while to get that printed, to get the order going and get delivered. By the time we get it, we'll probably already be in the courts as far as with our lawsuit. And, you know, I think before the end of the year, with the way things are going and justice has to be met because of all these people who have violated the law, subverted our government and our Constitution and we the people, you know, I think by that point, I think we'll be in as administrators. And then giving these booklets to the sheriff would be done really by the court administrators because not the court administrators, but the jury administrators. That would be the most powerful way to deliver those books.
Okay. In which county or state has NLA reached out and contacted the school board superintendents and so forth, informing them about the free civics and constitutional courses and the grand jury administrator positions.
Yeah. We have not done that yet. We will do that eventually. Right now, we need to get this case going, get the momentum going, get into the courts, start working with committeemen, and then we can start moving into the educational systems. We have to first become organized, and we need to do it across the nation, not just in one county here and one county there. We need to do it in every county. And so that requires organization. We get into the courts, we start filling the positions as administrators, we start to bring back the elected committeemen and filling those positions and teaching the people that are in the system that want to continue and do the right thing, then we'll be in that position to be able to really get out there into the public and get the public educated as best we can. We're working, you know, the book that we're writing is going to also become a textbook. We're going to take the book and make it a series of textbooks for the purpose of an education. But
okay.
That's coming up after we achieve other goals first.
And does NLA believe that a constitutional course should be mandatory in the curriculum requirements in the high schools before one can graduate?
Absolutely. Look, I don't believe that any more than 8-9 years of schooling is necessary for anyone. A proper education, an education that doesn't teach you what to think, but an education that teaches you how to think, okay, and get some freedom of thinking into those classes, to get real education going, a classical education. Eighth or ninth grade, you should easily be able to be reasonably at a college level at that point. We've seen that through that test we had back in 1800 and something, I forget, 1889 or something. We had a test. We have it up online, which everyone who looked at it said, this is college level. That was an eighth grade test, okay? Now, there's no reason. My son went to private school the first couple of years, and we homeschooled him. And we sent him to a very powerful, strong Christian school, but it was a very small school, very good, solid principal and leadership in that school. But he went to kindergarten, first grade, and second grade. We took him out in third grade to homeschool him. We're homeschooling our daughter. But up until that point, he probably had maybe a 6th, 7th grade education as what was out today. He could read at, 8th grade level. He could speak, he could sing, he can get up, there's no stage fright. They get these kids up young onto a stage to do things and give a speech or talk or sing or do something. And so any good school that really teaches children how to think, not what to think, but how to think, an education shouldn't take any more than 8 or 9 years. Of course, to further education, become a doctor or a dentist or an engineer and so on and so forth, you need to have a further education. But you should be able to achieve a standard college education to some degree, classical education, in 8-9 years. Most of what they deal in school is it's horrible. The children are retarded and not advanced. Next.
How old will one have to be a grand jury administrator?
Well, 18, I guess. I haven't thought about that, but why not 18?
Okay. Is there anyone within the platform of the NLA?
You know what? We might want to think that out. We should discuss that. Maybe it should be 21. I don't know. But that's something. Mm-hmm. Why don't you take the leadership and give thought to that and talk about it, and then we'll think about it again.
Okay. Next question, then, is there anyone within the platform of NLA a private attorney general? And if not, why not?
Well, look, I've heard about them. I really don't know what that is. I don't know what the qualifications are. I don't know what their purpose is. So if someone has that knowledge, maybe they can school us a little bit on it so we can understand it to see if it works with what we're doing. You know, if it's in harmony with what we're doing, maybe we should be doing it. But I've talked with people who talked about these things, but I've never been sufficiently answered to understand what it's all about to begin with. So if anybody has that knowledge, they can connect with Jan, and we can get together and talk a bit about it. Next.
And that's the last one.
Ooh, okay, we got through all of them.
Yep, that was
okay.
Quick. Good.
Did the best I could. And we want to try to move through our calls quickly so people, you know, one question. When we get to calls, we only want to get one question, maybe a follow-up question, and then we're going to move to the next person. If you want more questions, you can get back in the queue again and come back around a second time. We do want to try to get everyone in. We may spend a lot of time with individuals if we look into the queue and there isn't many people in the queue. We might spend more time than we should in some cases. But we would like to have more questions like the questions we just went through now. These are the kind of things that people should be asking. And also asking questions about the law, asking questions about the procedure, asking questions about the papers that we've written and different things. On all these subject matters that we're talking about, consent of government, that brings us both to the political and to the judicial side of things. If that's it, we'll move on to Brent. We done?
Yep, we're all done.
We're done, okay. Gerard, are you here?
Yes, I think I'm here. You can hear me, can't you?
Well, I can hear you, Brent, but I'm wondering, I see Gerard's here. Are you here, Gerard? Gerard, wake up. All right, well, hopefully he'll maybe let me know he's here on Skype and take control of the board. Otherwise, I'll keep control on it. So let me move over to you, Brent. Okay, Brent Winter is going to talk with us for a while. He's the author of The Excellence of the Common Law and some other books, and his website is commonlawyer.com. Brent, you got the mic.
Thank you so much, John. Thank you for the opportunity again to say a few words. You can also find all those books on Amazon.com. Just type in my name, Brent Allen Winters, A-L-L-A-N, and they'll come up right there in a row. Last time they did for me anyway. And give it a try that way, but otherwise you can go to commonlawyer.com. Take advantage of the free stuff that's there. I think there's about 200 audio clips. Press on the media button and they'll all come up in two windows, 100 clips in each window. Like sliced bread, you can pull them out. Unlike sliced bread, after you consume them, you can put them back. And then you can pull them out again if you're so inclined, but take advantage of the things that are up there. Even if you don't agree, it might stimulate your thinking and help you shore up your personal point of view. I know that's the way it works with me when I listen to people that I don't quite square with. Well, we left off last time going through the Declaration of... No, we did that. We're going through the Constitution of the United States. We're up in the, that part of it in Article 1 that talks about the writ of habeas corpus. What is a writ? Well, a writ is a writing. It's something that's writ, as they say, writ down. Written, it's an old word that means a writing, and it is a writing that orders from a superior to an inferior, ordering something to be done. Now, when somebody goes in and applies for the writ of habeas corpus, he's asking the court to command somebody by writing, in writing, to issue a writ commanding somebody to do what he wants them to do. Now, when it comes to habeas corpus, you're asking the court to issue a writing commanding a person who is holding someone in prison, imprisonment, jailing somebody, commanding them under pain of contempt to deliver the body of a certain person whom they're holding in jail or holding in a hospital or holding in a public school or holding in a house. Doesn't make a difference whether it's a jail, whether it's the government, whether it's not the government, anybody that's being falsely imprisoned or imprisoned. And you want the court, or that person wants the court, to command that the body of the prisoner be brought before the court, and the person holding the person in prison be required to prove that his holding of them in prison is lawful. If it doesn't prove it's lawful, doesn't satisfy the court on that point, then the court will issue an immediate declaration releasing the person on the spot. Freedom. The privilege, or the writ of habeas corpus, is not used like it used to be. As a matter of fact, in federal court, had legislation passed that says you've got to use it within a year. Within a year. All such things are wrong. It's wrong to tamper with this writ, to, if anything, err on the side of freedom. But Congress has done otherwise. And that does away with the writ of habeas corpus. Well, the writ of habeas corpus is our great weapon, we had said last time. Our great weapon available only in common law countries. And most of the rest of the world, they can throw you in jail, throw away the key, and forget about you. And it is true, when a person is imprisoned, they become largely forgotten. That's why the Savior of mankind says, visit those in prison. That's not easy to do, always. A fellow can get in trouble trying to visit somebody in prison. But it's wrong to forget them. It's the evil empire that imprisons people. And in our common law tradition, and even when people came to this new world from the old world, prisons weren't part of our tradition of religion, law, and government. Our common law only imprisoned people at that time in England and Britain and here. Only imprisoned people while they awaited trial. Now, it is true there have been some terrible abuses that way. People could be awaiting trial for 20 years. Well, that's clear abuse. And there were other devices put in place to stop that. But men weren't imprisoned. It's wrong. I'm going to say this and say it loudly. It's wrong to imprison people, except if they're waiting for trial and they can't make bail. And it's justified. They're a flight risk, for example. But to imprison people is not part of our common law tradition. Never has been. Not until the Quakers gave us the idea. The Quakers and Pennsylvania. And they came up with a goofy idea that there's a spark of good in every man. Well, you say it, but there is. I know there is. Well, just because you think it looks like there is, or I think it looks like there is, or we believe it, God says otherwise, and our prison systems prove that. What the Quakers said is this. The Quakers said there's a spark of good in every man. Of course, that's contrary to what Paul the Apostle says and the prophets. And they say it in pretty clear terms. Matter of fact, terms so clear that it's not the thing to do to repeat them in polite company. But that's the raw truth. Quakers said there's a spark of good in every man. And if you take a criminal, now this is American history, this is what really happened. You take a criminal and lock him in a room with a Bible and tell him to read his Bible and pray, but you give him enough time, when he comes out, he'll be a reformed man. And they called such places where they did that, they practiced this in Pennsylvania. And they called those places, places of penance. And they called them then later penitentiaries. And Alex de Tocqueville, which is often quoted by conservatives and patriots because of the things he said about America, the observations he made. He wrote a book about his observations of America. But what is never said about de Tocqueville, he was from France. His government sent him to America to examine this new invention called the penitentiary. That's really why he came. And they wanted to import the idea to France. Of course, France already had the idea. What's the idea? You throw people in jail with the idea that when they come out, they'll be reformed. Now, we in America today have said the same thing. We don't want to admit we have any Christian sensibilities, so it'd be terrible to say you were a Quaker. The government's never going to say that. So what? Instead of calling them penitentiaries, what do they call them now? Prisons? No, that's too ugly. Jails? No, they don't do that. They have the same ridiculous theological point of view, but they won't admit it. They call them correctional institutions. Correctional institutions. Listen, the only people that anybody can point to that's been corrected in a correctional institution are the people that don't have a pinch of a sliver of a hope of ever getting out. 2-3 life sentences. They're there. There are people that are there that say, I've been reformed. But even if they are reformed, even if you could argue that, it wasn't the prison that changed them. I had a guy tell me one time, I was on the radio, and he called, we were talking about this, and a big chunk of our listeners were at the Crossbar Hotel, we called it, the Crossbar Hotel, the federal prison in Terre Haute, Indiana, where the Timothy McVeigh was executed. He got well known because of that, I suppose. But they would listen to us. And one fellow called in whose brother happened to be in prison. And he said, I thank God for prisons. I said, why? The Bible doesn't authorize them anywhere. Dungeons and prisons for the evil empire. He said, well, I still thank God for them. Well, you can do that if you want. That's all right. It's good to be thankful in all things. But I said, why do you? He said, because my brother found God in prison. Well, that's something to be thankful for. But that doesn't justify doing wrong and saying we ought to have prisons. God can do anything. Anything he wants in any ugly situation, he can do whatever he wants in the midst of your ugliness and your sin. And he does. And he takes the most evil acts of men and turns them to good. He's the only one that can do that. He's the only one that can make a straight lick with the crooked stick. The most dastardly deed that was ever done was the turning over, the Jews turning over the Savior of mankind to the Romans to be murdered. But God turned it to our good. All things work together, says Paul the Apostle, to them who are called according to his purpose. Well, that's another subject. But just because God works within our own evil doesn't mean that we are to continue in sin and thank God and make sure we have plenty of prison so people can become Christian people. That's silly. Paul says, what should we do then? Sin that grace may abound more? God forbid, he said. Does grace abound more when men sin? You bet it does. Does that mean we should sin more? No, it doesn't. That was the doctrine of Judaism for centuries. Well, it still is, really. They say the Messiah won't come until things get really rotten, so let's just help him out and get as rotten as we can. There was a fellow in the Middle Ages that made that point of view famous, Jewish fellow. Well, prisons are not part of our common law tradition. They're not part of our fundamental heritage of religion, of Christianity. Not at all. But yet the Quakers introduced the idea through their faulty view of mankind. And here we are with the mess. It is an industry. In a lot of the states it is. In the federal system, it's incorporated in about 1935 under the communist president, Roosevelt. No, don't say he was mild compared to today. No, he was worse compared to today. He just tried to hide it. He was a Bolshevik. There's no doubt about it. He wanted to recognize the Bolsheviks, their government, and did so. He pushed for it. The American people didn't want it. But he did as he may well please, and my children won't see the end of the... My father used to tell me this is true. My children won't see the end of the damage that fella did to our country, along with the cronies that were foolish enough to follow him. And I've known them in my own lifetime. There are, of course, not as many around us as there used to be. Well, habeas corpus is important because imprisonment is against the revelation of God, the laws of nature, unwritten in the nature of things, and the laws of nature's God written, as Blackstone tells us, in the Bible. Why? Well, because it's against the fundamental covenant, the trust settlement with our father Adam, to be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. You cannot fill, you cannot spread out upon the faces of our earth, as God has commanded the race of Adam to do. Conquer the land. Make it productive to the glory of its maker, God. That's why we're here. And fundamental to that is spreading out, and you can't spread out on impulse. I examine, and I've been involved in mining law, so I'm familiar with the mining law of 1872. It was a companion act to the Homestead Act. The purpose of the Homestead Act is now fulfilled, so it is no more. The agricultural lands of the Midwest have been settled. The Mining Act of 1872 was designed to settle the mineralized lands of the West. Well, that hasn't happened yet, so it's still in force, at least in the law, whether or not in fact. But the whole premise of both of those acts, now the Mining Act of 1872, is that men should be absolutely free to enter public lands, upon, watch this word, impulse. Freedom means that you can get up and exercise locomotion, go where you want to go on impulse. I'm tired of sitting at home. I'm going on a road trip to St. Louis, or I'm going on a road trip to Paducah, or I'm going on a road trip to Kansas City. And up, you got a buck in your pocket, you got gas in your tank, and you're out of here. That's called freedom to travel. Now they're talking about having IDs, federal IDs. Why? So they can keep track of you. So they can restrict your right, a God-given right to travel on impulse. What does it come back to? It comes back to the fundamental trust settlement of God. You can read about it in the first few chapters of the book called Genesis. Our common law is based upon those kinds of first principles even before. We're talking about the Ten Commandments. That's good. But this is a principle the Ten Commandments arises out of. This is before the Ten Commandments. This is the law of God, His will. And habeas corpus is part of our tradition in order to ensure the fulfillment of that. Well, let me pick up where we left off last time. Indispensable to the civil canon law's devices of inquisition is the power of government to hold the target of its investigation under arrest in order to wear him down, discourage him, and subdue him into conformity with the will of the state. Now, if you haven't had this happen to you, it's hard to imagine. Just like if you haven't been thrown in prison, it's hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine the oppression of such a place. But take the word of those people that have been thrown in. Most people that have been in prison don't talk about it that much. Have you noticed? Oh, they don't think anybody cares. They know nobody to relate to it. It's like combat veterans. You don't hear them talking much about it till they get really old. How do I know? I've known lots of them. They don't talk about it. Why? Well, number one, same thing. They don't think anybody wants to listen. Number two, they know if they tell you, you either won't believe them. Yeah, you won't believe it. Or even if you did believe it, you can't really relate to it. How do you relate to people trying to blow each other's heads off at point-blank range or slaughter each other with machetes? How do you relate to that if you haven't done it or had that threat come right on you? Well, you can't. How can you relate to someone exercising, somebody in government, putting the blackjack on you, pulling a gun on you, sicking the dogs on you, holding you down, beating you up, throwing you in jail? How can you relate to that if it hasn't happened to you? You can't. But we should try to do the best we can to listen to the testimonies of those that have had that experience. Maybe it will move people to say, we've got to stop this. Well, habeas corpus was designed to that very purpose, to stop false imprisonment. It's oppressive. Well, back in the year 1679, in response to such practices of priestcraft and kingcraft, and to enforce our common law right of habeas corpus, Parliament passed the Habeas Corpus Act. The Habeas Corpus Act, 31 CAR 2, 1679, that's the way the British people cite it, is one of the four great charters of English liberty, now part of our federal constitution. The other three charters of English liberty, by the way, those are ours, We are of the English-speaking world, and we are of the English culture. That's back to history. And the other three great charters of English liberty are, number one, Magna Carta, the 15th of June, the year 1215. Number two, the English Petition of Right of the year 1628. And number three, the English Bill of Rights, 1 William and Mary, the year 1689. William and Mary held the crown at that time. One rightly adds to this list the United States Constitution because its purpose was and is, at bottom, identical with these foregoing four charters of liberty. What is that purpose? To reaffirm, not to affirm, but to reaffirm, to reach back. Each one of them reached back and tried to establish something that was very old that had been forgotten, and to uphold neglected government limiting common law rights. Our Constitution is nothing new. I grow weary of people saying these people were geniuses. James Madison was a genius. George Washington, Tom Jefferson. Well, I'm sure they were intelligent men. As a matter of fact, I'm fully convinced of it. But what they were really doing was observing what had happened in the past. And as Justice James Wilson of the Supreme Court, on the first panel of the Supreme Court, observed, our common law is, well, to sum it up, he said this, we're more English than the English. Why? He said, because our Constitution doesn't try to establish the common law as it now exists in England. It reaches back and tries to establish the common law as it stood before Magna Carta, among the Anglo-Saxons, the Anglo-Danes, and the Celts. And he says, too, it was much more sensitive to private individual rights of property. Yeah, rights of property. Matter of fact, any rights you have are rights of property. You don't have any rights given by God. That's what a right is, given direct to you by God. Every one of them is a right of property. How do I know? Well, just, I guess, think it through, but it's been said before. You have property in your rights, and you have rights in your property. And if you don't have rights in your tangible property, you have no property in your intangible rights either. These are different forms, just like water and ice are different forms of H2O. Property and rights stress different forms of the same thing. Lawyers say if you have a piece of real estate, what you really have is a bundle of rights. Bundle, key word, bundle of rights. That's really what it is. Tie it all up together in a bow. There you go. Here's your bundle of rights to the property. And they hand you the bundle of rights. If you buy it, property doesn't move, just stays right where it is, if it's real estate. Well, Habeas Corpus Act 1679 fixed and ensured a sure-footed procedure for all those jailed, whereby the one jailed, or a concerned party for the one jailed, could petition the court to command the jailer to bring his prisoner before the court and convince the court that the imprisonment is lawful. That's the gravamen of habeas corpus. That is, it satisfies common law due process. In short, the writ of habeas corpus burdens the jailer to prove that his jailing of the petitioner is lawful. That's another short, terse way of saying it. Let me repeat it. The writ of habeas corpus burdens the jailer to prove before the court that his jailing of the petitioner is lawful. The writ of habeas corpus is applicable against not only the government, but also against anyone holding another person falsely. For example, the writ can run against a parent or other family member having false custody of a child, whether by mistake, misunderstanding, or by willful intent, that is, by kidnapping. The writ can also run against a hospital for holding a person without right. I snuck out of a hospital once. They tried to hold me. I didn't consider the writ of habeas corpus, and I wasn't mad at them. They'd done a good job of taking care of me. But we watched closely. I had to get out of there. I knew I was okay. I had a nurse watching me. She helped me pull out all the plugs in my body. I had all these needles in my arms, and she stood watched down at the nurse's station, and I snuck out the side door. I was still a little bit on morphine, but I was okay. I felt fine. I suppose in a case like that, if they tried to keep you too long, I've known people that have gone to the hospital and tried to leave, and they wouldn't let them leave. Well, this safeguard against false imprisonment enables fulfillment of God's covenant, as I had said, to spread out and fill the earth. The Habeas Corpus Act created no new right against unlawful imprisonment. The common law has always forbade false imprisonment, always, for centuries before Habeas Corpus, but instead provided a wrongfully jailed man, a real, in-place, readily available procedural remedy enabling enjoyment of this ancient right, this ancient. How ancient? Genesis chapter 1, 2, and 3. That's pretty ancient. Upon a jailed party's petition protesting false imprisonment, the court will issue this great writ to the jailer, commanding that he make return on the writ by bringing the prisoner's body, that is, his corpus. You see, corpus is the Latin word for body. That's why we say habeas corpus. Habeas means we have corpus, the body. We have the body. Who has the body? The jailer. Well, you've got the body? Bring the body here. I don't mean come here and argue. I mean bring the body. And if they don't bring the body, that's not the writ of habeas corpus. It must say bring the body to satisfy the court that the imprisonment is lawful. If not, the body of the prisoner will be released forthwith immediately, not on paper, not by a signed order only, no. The judge will ensure that right then and there that they turn loose of him, unhandcuff him, whatever, in his presence. Oh, just to return, to go back. Go back to the way it was before the government and other presumptive sillies like Quakers messed it up. Now, I've got friends that are Quakers. I like them very much. I don't think most of them know what the doctrine of Quakerism is. They just like to go to church. But the doctrine of Quakerism is false. And I don't want to hesitate to say it because the damage that's been done is so overwhelming. And here we are still struggling with it. False doctrine is evil, even if it comes from nice people. Shucks, everybody in Congress is a nice person. I was sitting in Congress once. No, I wasn't a member. I was sitting up in the gallery. It was about midnight. It was the night that Clinton's crime bill passed. They were there. I saw the lights on. I went in. That was before they shook you down when you went in the Capitol building. We had freedom of locomotion. We could go right in. And the fellow sitting beside me said, he nudged me, said, "See all those congressmen down there?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Every one of those fellows is a nice guy." Well, I was looking at some of them, and I knew who they were. I'd seen them on TV, and I knew they weren't nice fellows. And I pointed that out to him, that these people are dangerous, some of them. He said, "I know they're dangerous, and I know that they're evil, and I know that they're hurting us, but they're still nice guys." I said, "How do you know?" He said, "Well, you can't be elected to office without acting like you're a nice guy, at least, and know how to act like it. Don't be charmed by evil. Charm is deceitful, the Bible says. Be careful." And even people that I like, I'm sure I've got some wrong ideas. If I knew where they were, I'd change them. I really think I would, but I think a lot of us are blind and we're not intentionally wrong. My Quaker friends aren't intentionally wrong, but that's wrong. And it would be acceptable if it weren't so devastating. And so it's an industry. The criminal law industry in America is an industry, and it's getting bigger. Well, if the jailing power, of course, fails to meet the burden, as I'd said, you got to release him on the spot in front of the court. Let's see, check the time. Can I finish this part? I'll do another little bit. The writ of habeas corpus commands the jailer to bring his prisoner before the court for two reasons. Number one, first, that the petitioner for habeas corpus may testify, call witnesses, cross-examine witnesses, and make an oral argument. Second, And if the court finds that the law demands his release, he will be set free on the spot, as I had said, avoiding the jailer's dallying, or outright refusal. Of great note, the writ of habeas corpus requires that the jailer, whether sheriff, police chief, hospital administrator, warden, military officer, know, understand, and show good and lawful cause for the jailing of the person in question. Further, the burden is on the jailer to prove the lawfulness of his holding the one jailed. The one jailed need prove nothing. Nothing. He needn't say nothing. Burden's on the other fellow. The one jailed doesn't have to say anything about his circumstances. In short, the one jailed need prove nothing or otherwise testify at all. All the stories I want to tell about habeas corpus. I suppose I'll stop here. I want to tell you the story about a man that became Supreme Court Justice of the United States. Yeah, he was falsely jailed as a lawyer in a makeshift courtroom in a frontier town in California. And he applied for the writ of habeas corpus. And before it was over, the judge had to pull a gun on the sheriff himself. What a story. And I read it. I read his affidavit of what happened and why it happened. And that started a series of violence, challenges to duels. What adventure. Well, I'll tell that story next time, Lord willing. That was about Justice Fields. And Justice Field, because he understood habeas corpus, he wrote some of the most powerful opinions right after the war between the northern and the southern tiers of the states concerning the Union Army's jailing of men and holding them without cause, just because they wanted to. And he wasn't a Southerner, he was from New England. He saw the madness of all the things that were happening, though. And he wrote against them, Justice Stephen Field. What a wonderful, wonderful choice for Supreme Court Justice. Of all the bad things that Abraham Lincoln is said to have done, such as ignore the writ of habeas corpus during the duration of war, jailing over 800 men without cause. He did appoint Justice Field as Supreme Court Justice. So that was a good thing. Oh, one other thing I don't want to forget, because I think I failed to mention it last time. Spoke to a fellow recently, and a smart fellow. He made the comment to me when I had mentioned about Abraham Lincoln jailing over 800 men, and he would not respond to the federal courts when they issued the writ of habeas corpus. He ordered his army officers to not release the men jailed. Of course, that put the army officers in a precarious position. So they had to say, well, am I going to support the Constitution of the United States or make sure my career is a success and obey the president? Well, sadly to say, they obeyed the president. But it's important. It's important to recognize it says in the Constitution, the writ of the habeas corpus clause, as it is called, it says this, it's short, let me read it again. The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless, I'm going to focus on the unless, the exception, unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it. Is there exception? Yes. There is a time when it can be lawfully justified. The question is, and this is what I was trying to get across to this other fellow, who has the power to suspend it? The President of the United States? Or, what other choices do we have? The federal courts or the Supreme Court of the United States? Or the Congress of the United States? This should be taught in law schools. It isn't. This is so important. The great writ is so important. It's the great writ. No other writ in our common law tradition is called great. Just this one. And remember, it is one of the four charters of English liberty. Tom Jefferson said that we don't have to worry about not having freedom in America. Our Constitution says the writ of habeas corpus shall never be suspended. Well, the President of the United States suspended it. Also, President Delano Roosevelt suspended it during World War II. He imprisoned Italian Americans without cause, without justification, ignoring the writ of habeas corpus. Even the mother and father, some beloved baseball players were Italian, and their parents were jailed for the duration of the war. Did the same thing to the Japanese Americans that lived in California and other places. Did the same thing. Well, the President of the United States, according to Justice Joseph Story, does not have the authority to suspend the writ of habeas corpus. Well, then who does? Well, clearly, this is Article 1 of the Constitution. Article 1. Well, what is the Article 1 about the President of the United States and his powers? No, not at all. Is it about the Supreme Court of the United States and its powers? No, not at all. That's Articles 2 and 3. This is Article 1. This is about Congress of the United States, and that's why Justice Story, in his commentaries on the Constitution, written 38, 39 years after the ratification of this Constitution, he said it's clear, only Congress has the power to suspend the writ of habeas corpus. But yet, we Americans don't say a pinch of nothing about what Roosevelt did. We say, oh, that was wrong, but we don't say why. It's wrong because the Constitution says he doesn't have that authority. That's why it's wrong. Let's get to the bottom of things with our Constitution. That's where we're losing it. That's where our freedoms are fleeting away, and the police state presses on us apace. Well, this is Brent Allen Winters. My comments are my own, not necessarily the opinions of National Liberty Alliance. It's important that we all come to our own conclusions, and I'm hoping I can persuade you and urge you to my conclusions. That's why I say what I say, and I appreciate again John and Gerard and the others allowing me a few moments to talk. Back to you, Gerard, if you're there. If you aren't, back to John.
Thank you, Brent.
Thank you, Gerard.
I'm going to open up the floor.
Yeah, let me just make a note here. Maybe we will try to restrict each call to 5 minutes so we can get through all the calls before midnight. Terry or Jan, if we hit 5 minutes, just put a reminder out there. 5 minutes is all you got to say, and we kind of know we got to wind it down and move to the next person. But go ahead, Gerard.
Happy to oblige.
I'm sure you are.
Just pull the cord and I'll fall into the tub, you know. Like.
We shall see.
Yeah. Okay. We have somebody from Pennsylvania. It just says PA.
Yeah, this is Drew from Luzerne County. I talked to you before about the wife and granddaughter leaving and filing the special petition. I got a hearing tomorrow morning on that. They since filed a PFA on me, and the judge didn't put it on me, though, because I kind of challenged her Title 23 that she has there. So she didn't put that on me, but she kind of got me on that because she then continued it till August. So I'm going to be filing something back because I'm not going to be going till August under a
temporary
order. What's that? Challenge jurisdiction?
Yep.
On the PFA?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, what I did was I went in and she, you know, had the story there and whatever, and I said, well, according to your, you know, Chapter 61, Title 23, Subsection 6102 and 6103, I said, she said, and I'm like, yeah, it's a big book, I said, but not all of that pertains to the share. So tiny says more being up there.
You're kind of like breaking it up pretty bad. Is that just me, or is he breaking up to you too?
No, it probably is. I'm on a phone that doesn't get the real good signal. I'm in a very rural area.
Getting like every third word there.
So what should I do with challenging the jurisdiction on the?
PFA. What kind of court is this now?
Well, it was a PFA court.
Which means.
There was protection from abuse.
It's like a family court, John.
Yeah, it's an orphan's court, the family court, yeah.
Yeah, family court.
If you're in family court, you can challenge the jurisdiction and move it into a court of record. You know, look at anything that family court really does, okay, at some point when they get into the real heavy decisions, they got to move over and have a judge come and get involved.
Yeah, because the custody hearing, you know, but I believe I'm not going to allow them to do that, and I've done nothing, so that's why they couldn't get the PFA, you know.
Yeah, this is a problem that we may have to wait to really, to solve the problem we get to the other side here, so, you know, but you can try to challenge jurisdiction and move it into a real court, even though the family court is, at least in New York, family court is considered a court of record, but I don't know how they figure that out.
Well, I did look up the jurisdiction on this. I looked up how they have jurisdiction, and there's apparently something they made that's all the states are involved in this unified Child Custody Act or something that they have. I don't know, and it was.
I didn't participate in that. Did you?
I didn't participate in that either. No, I didn't participate in that either. But that's where they figure they get the jurisdiction from, you know.
Look, as long as lawyers are involved with dealing with family issues, it's going to be nothing but hell. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I didn't take a lawyer into the PFA.
Huh?
I didn't take a lawyer into the PFA. I went by myself.
I understand that, but everyone else has a lawyer. And the problem is, they're not there to solve anything.
Right. I understand that. Yeah.
And we got to get rid of that whole thing. Look, regular people have to take control of that. People who can have compassion. People who can, you know, if you put a panel there of people and pay them, you know, but put a panel of people there that really dig in to see what's going on and try to figure things out and make sure they don't violate the child's rights. Because, look, that child has a right to a father as much as it does to a mother.
Well, I'm the grandfather.
You know, and all these false charges and stuff. Every time I see anything go into family court, it's always the lies and the lies. And, you know, they even get, they work on the women most of the time to get them to sign things that aren't true. And
yeah, but can't they be perjured? Can't they be, like, they're signing false statements. Can't that be perjury? And can't that be, contempt?
Well, it's a lot of things, but right now there's not much we could do about it until we get to the other side. But you can challenge a jurisdiction, move it into a court of record, and really, you know, take it before, a panel to begin with, or at least a judge to begin with, and say, look,
How do I request that from the judge tomorrow?
Well, you have to file a paper. I wouldn't just challenge it because they'll make a decision that they got it. You want to put it in writing and let them respond in writing, because they got to respond point by point that you make. But, we have that information up on the website. Anybody wants to challenge the jurisdiction, you just go up to due process, click on due process, and follow the instructions.
I'll do
We've got 5 or 6 documents in there that goes through that process. I think it's 5 documents and 1 instruction sheet. And,
I appreciate that. I'm going to go on there, look it up, print it out. I'm not going to hold you up no longer. Thank you.
That whole system needs to be revamped in every state of the union. It's just a mess.
Yeah, I know. All right, thanks a lot.
All right.
Bye.
Hi, this is Barbara Troger. I'm in New York, Westchester County. And I just want to know, briefly about the possible process for this. I see online that if people are posed with being told you have to get a vaccination for such and such, or even have a certain new meter put on your house for your phone, which you find very unhealthy, that if you're being told that this is mandatory, that you can deal with that by having paperwork that says if you're going to do this, you have to sign these papers of liability. Is that the way to deal with it? And then hopefully they just go away. Because both of those things are something you can't even sue, because harm is so certain. So how do you deal with this situation? Hello?
Gerard, you want to handle that one? You know more about that than I do.
I'm sorry, I was talking and I was muted. I didn't know it.
Well, shouldn't be talking.
I said,
she's talking about the problem with the meters and also vaccination. They're trying to tell them it's a force.
They're not going to sign any paper that you give them. They're going to refuse to. They just won't
do
it.
So how do you get out?
That doesn't stop them from bringing a couple police over to put that meter on your house. Now, basically, they don't really have the authority to put that meter on your house. You know, we were working with Cal and them with In Power. And
by the way, we should get in touch with him and try to bring him in to work with us and create a committee for that.
Yeah, he's going to be at that forum. He's one of the speakers. But anyway, I'll discuss that with you when we're off. You got to be able to file the paperwork. You got to be able to make the claim, and basically, when you have a meter on your house, whether you signed a paper or not, it's a contract you've been paying on. So there's a certain period of time where you got to give them a notice of liability and say, look, I was never given a chance. It's a contract, and since you didn't get a chance to negotiate that contract, did you?
A year ago, they sent me these opt-out papers for the current one. They put in a new one a year ago, and I opted out. And as a result, I'm paying $9.50 every month, which I hear is really not legal. But they gave me advance, opportunity to opt out. I don't know. Well, from what I've heard,
opt-out papers put you in a box. If you read that paper, the reason they gave you an opt-out paper, you should have sued them, is what you should have done. You should have said, no, I'm sticking to my old contract, whatever it was, and I don't need to opt out of anything since I'm not in it to begin with.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? So by signing an opt-out paper, it's like you're trying to change the contract. No, they were the ones that were trying to change the contract. You know? So every time you pay your bill and all that, under law, that's your acquiescence. So that's your adhesion contract. It means you agree to whatever their terms of service are at that point. But when they come in and they try to change it, you gotta say, look, at whatever it was before, that's what I'm sticking to. I'm not agreeing to a new contract. I do not wish to contract with you further. I do not wish to change my contract. And so that's a civil matter. It's not criminal. I don't know how they think they can get police to come up there and arrest you for not putting this meter on your property,
Are people doing that? Is it happening?
I've heard that they threaten people and they're going to bring the police.
Yeah, well, the president gave a speech saying that everyone had to do it. It was mandatory and everyone was going to do it.
Mandatory? Why? From where? Who declared that? Is that a national emergency?
President Trump said that it was going to be mandatory, not only in the cities, but rural areas and everywhere.
Oh, really? President Trump did what? Made an executive order?
I don't know.
No, they're just giving you a bunch of baloney. They're not. What they're doing is they're saying the law says, and they're not showing you the law. Tell them, show me the law.
I know that.
Show me the law. Don't tell me it's mandatory. Show me the law.
Show me the law. Okay.
Show me the law. Where is it?
That's what.
And show me where I'm mentioned in the law. Me.
Oh, really? Okay.
That's right. They could do certain things to corporations, but they can't do things to private citizens.
Okay.
Can we give Cal's website? Maybe she can go out there and work with some of those forms.
Well, yeah, that's a good one. In Power. I think it's just InPower.com, I think, isn't it?
InPower.com.
InPower, P-O-W-E-R, InPower.
Okay.
He shows you how to file a notice of liability, and they've had some successes. What they did was they filed a notice of liability on the CEOs and the guys in the offices, you know what I mean, that says that they would give them notices one after the other, and of course they would always default. You know, they're not going to answer them, but what it says is that they're liable for your health problems, and he's got some really good paperwork. I don't want to spend time explaining it here. Go to InPower and go through his stuff. And basically, now as far as vaccination goes, vaccination is another thing completely different than the meters. I mean, it's even worse because they're violating your body. I mean, they're really
it's horrible.
They're really violating your First Amendment.
Okay.
Many other things, but
all right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, and meanwhile, we may try to connect with Cal and try to get something going here with us so that we can probably have some of this paperwork here and a page and maybe a committee or something. I don't know.
That would be great.
Okay, we'll take the next caller.
Okay, thank you.
We want everyone to 5 minutes so that we can get through all the people that's in the queue tonight. We don't want to leave everyone hanging. So tonight's 5-minute limit.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Okay, let me hit the button here. Get my glasses back on. Ron from Arkansas, you're on, buddy.
He may just be stuck in the queue. I don't know.
Oh, he was in there earlier? He was talking, right? Ron's stuck in the queue, going once.
Gary says I missed that message.
Yeah, me too. Let me see if I can bring it back up. It's InPowerMovement.com. InPowerMovement.
Is that IM or IN?
No, M. Spelled it IM. InPower.
Okay.
IMPOWER Movement.com.
Okay.
Very good site. Good information. Cal is pretty good. Okay, I don't think Ron is here. I'm going to go to the next guy. Let me hear. Okay. This is Terry, isn't it?
Yes. I have a question about the private attorney general doctrine, but I have to give you a little background. I went to court today, and I forced my landlord to refund several hundred dollars in fraudulent sewer fees, and I got the judge to reverse himself finally after the third hearing. So here's the situation. I got him to refund like $400 in sewer fees, but the problem is it cost me like $300 in transcripts and various costs and time and money to get that done. So I had asked the judge about this a couple of months ago when we had our earlier hearing, and I asked for a private attorney my fees under the private attorney general doctrine, and he denied it. But that was before he reversed himself. So I'm kind of wondering whether that's a
attorney general.
What's that?
You don't need to be a private attorney general to get your fees back. I mean, it's a nice idea if you can get them to do that. Private attorney general, it comes from a judge bequeathing it on you for that particular, issue.
Right.
And you don't need to be a lawyer. He understands that you are learned on the facts of that issue, and it has to be good for somebody else besides you, like the general population. And then you can become a private attorney general, and they let you take cases that are in the public interest that you have shown that you have expertise on. But look, you could take them to small claims court as yourself, and if it's under, I think it's up to $5,000 or $6,000 now, small claims court.
But
so build it up as best you can and put it in there. And, you know, they hate small claims court because, you know, you're suing this corporation and they have to bring their lawyer in there. You know, it's stupid for them to try to fight it. They should just pay it, because by the time they get the lawyer and all that stuff in there, they're going to lose anyway. The judge already returned your fee. What are they going to say? It's like, so sue them in the small claims court. They probably won't even show up. You'll win by default probably.
All right. That sounds good. That was actually my first inclination, but our friend suggested I go back into the same court. This originated in landlord-tenant, but I can already see.
Yeah, go back to the same court and look for damages. It costs you money to defend this whole thing. So see if they can add that on. If not, do what Gerard says, try small claims.
Yeah, well, that was what I was going to do. I was going to do another motion in that court to get those fees, because I did vindicate a public right. All the other tenants in this development who hopefully I'm working with the New Jersey Tenants Organization to get these people organized. So if I save myself several hundred dollars, there's no reason why I can't do that to the rest of the tenants in this development.
You have the right to charge for your services. You have a right to take a percentage of what you just won. When he turned that fee back and that affected all those tenants, you can actually exact a fee from all those tenants if you wanted to for your legal work. Private attorney generals do get paid.
Right, right.
Okay.
When you vindicate a public right.
Right, absolutely, which is absolutely what you did.
Right. Well, you know, I asked him about that. You know, well, actually, I asked him about they also charge an illegal clean out fee when you end your lease. And he kind of like, oh, well, I can't get involved with that. You know, I can only deal with the issue that's before me right now. And it sounded like a cop out, you know?
Well, of course, he doesn't want to stick his neck out. You already had his neck strung out there, and he wasn't going to give you any more. Because, you know, they're going to come back, why'd you do that? But, you know, look, he just doesn't want to use his common sense.
Right.
You know, he's going to say, I don't know what a clean out is. Well, that's where there's poop in the hole and you scoop it out with a shovel. That's what it is, Judge. Can't you rule on that? You know?
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm a little reluctant to go back and file another motion with this judge. I'm thinking about filing it, you know, and like you said, in small claims court. It's only going to be like, I want to be reimbursed for my time and money as well as my...
It would be nice if you could be a private attorney general, because you'll be doing a service. Plus, you'll get more than your fee back. You'll get a percentage from... I don't know the exact methodology. I'll tell you who did it was Rod Class became a private attorney general, and he knows all the ins and outs about how it's set up. I know just enough to make me dangerous. Well, I'm telling you that you can do that, and it has to be a public interest thing, and yes, you can get paid. You can exact a fee. You know, and matter of fact, why don't you work on making a paper or a notice for all those people that are going to fall under your thing as a private attorney general, and what you do is you say, look, I get 10% of what I save you. You know what I mean? And so then you file the papers for them in the court. And it'll be something like mentioning your case. I'm resting in Terry Culpepper's case, blah, 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 for this illegal thing that was charged to everybody. And then you have them fill that paperwork out, notarize it, and send it in the court. When they get their check, they can pay you. I mean, that's my suggestion. I don't know, you know. You do some research.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Don't go fly off the handle with my advice, you know what I mean? But I'm telling you that it's what I'm telling you is 99% right. You got to figure out you got to tweak it so that it's completely legal. That's all. I'm you know what I mean?
Okay, I appreciate it. Hopefully I can bring these tenants on as NLA members down the road.
There you go. It sounds good. Okay.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Okay, Dan from Carolinas. Are you there?
Yes, sir. This is Dan. I got a couple of things, but I don't know. Our time frame usually is not much when I get to speak, and because I've got to respect other people. Let me start this way. I've been inside and reading, as we, especially tonight, commonlawyer.com, Mr. Winter's his website. I've got an unusual situation. I'm trying to consider a common law trust, even though I have, by will, a deed that's been cut by the estate attorney, I hope I said that correctly. But I'm wanting to do a reverse mortgage because to settle the estate, there's been so much complexity between myself and my brother that it's going to cost megabucks. And so I've done everything for the government and taken all the stuff and countless seminars or whatever you call it, and every time we get to a point to where that they don't like the fact this when I do a to work with a bank for a reverse mortgage, that because my brother has put some fraudulent, erroneous, purported deeds on the record, that they want that cleared up. And, of course, he did this with a fraudulent POA, and we've had him in court, and he had to admit it. And I brought it to the authorities' attention, and they have not prosecuted him because he actually committed perjury and everything else at the same time when he was shown in court and had to answer up that he fabricated a POA on my mother. And so then he put these deeds to mess up the title to the homestead. And by the way, in the will, he shouldn't even been in court in this particular case at all because the property was not in the will to him, not even a percentage. It was the property that was clearly to go to me. So I know that sounds complicated and everything else because but that's where he got caught and in a case in the county.
Did you say that you wanted to also create a common law trust?
Well, I'm wanting your guys' expertise and to expound on it because
I'll put together a paper on how and instructions on how to create a common law trust. And I'll post it up on under due process with the rest of the papers that we're putting up there. So I'll post it under there. I'll try to get it done maybe by next Monday. We'll see if I can get the time.
John, he's worried about the deed that the estate lawyer cut for the
property.
But it doesn't matter, does it?
Let me say this. This is what I really am concerned with. The deed is, and the county, I had to go through GIS, and they approved my maps and everything to validate me totally the owner. But where my brother put some third parties on there, this is causing problems when I start to do the due process part of going and getting a reverse mortgage. And my point is, that I'm trying to bring to you guys, if I do a common law trust, isn't it going to take it out of my name and put the property in a trustee? And when I go to do a reverse mortgage, the property's going to be in the trust. Will that be a complication, or should the bank that does reverse mortgage proceed with my application?
Go ahead, John. You know about
that's a good question. I'm not sure I have the answer for that. But
I don't think they can. I think he's right.
The question
really
is your brother in conflict with you, or he just made some stupid mistakes?
Yes, he's in conflict. He's trying to steal the property.
He's been in conflict, but now it's come to my understanding, I don't know this personally without putting him in a courtroom, that he's incompetent now, and he's got his wife in the state of North Carolina as with a tremendous document to oversee. and she is peddling our property that belongs to my parents' estate. And, Lord, he took monies, just about 10 seconds on this so you understand. He took monies using his power of attorney that he drafted himself, while at the same time my mother's attorney and his attorney were collaborating, officers of the court, and they were spellbound. They had no clue that he drafted this while he was under notice, and the notice was that from mother's attorney that he had stolen countless amounts of money, CDs, and we could go on and on with this. So he actually was practicing law to create the power of attorney, and he forged her name because she was not confident and could have not signed or done what the instrument is showing on those lines to save her life. And so anyway, he was caught because the truth of the matter is we had the documents from the physician, and he's the one who carried my mother over into Wilmington, North Carolina to, I won't call the facility, but I can tell you I would privately if I talked to some of you guys. And in closing, when he did, it was before the fact, or in other words, after the fact of him carrying my mother, knowing she was going to be declared mentally incompetent, that he concocted and fabricated the. And I had, you won't believe this, I had a POA on my mother that the bank asked because she was in my care at my home, in our home. And there is a situation where that they would have had to go in court and struck down my POA for him to ever put his mess on there. And those authorities up there.
Now, without getting too deep into the story, and
yeah,
it is getting
you,
late,
I got you.
Here's the thing. Here's what I'm thinking here. You create yourself a common law trust, okay? And I'll put the instructions up there how to do it. If you can successfully everything into that common law trust, then at that point you should be in a safe position. Now, remember, you don't reveal who the beneficiary is. If you try to go get a bank account for that trust, I know with one bank I tried to set things up, and they wanted to know, they had a questionnaire, and they wanted to know the beneficiary, they wanted to know, they don't know information, it was none of their business. I told them, well, what's the purpose of a common law trust if I'm going to give you all that information? None of your business. So they wouldn't open the account, so I went to another bank, and they didn't give me a hard time, and I was able to get in. So some banks and some people might give you a hard time. But look, once you move it into the trust, it gets under the trust name, they don't know who the beneficiary is. You don't reveal that. You can then maybe make motions and do whatever it is you want to try to do possibly then.
Just give me a second on this. There is serious situations of taxes that has to be paid because this is tremendous value of property. It's waterfront property. And on the intercoastal waterway from Maine to Florida. And so with that said, I'm wanting to do a common law, a reverse mortgage to help free up some funds there and also have funds to be able to further.
Another thing here, and I didn't think about this before, but maybe it's something you could try. You know, if there's taxes owed on the property, and is that gone into the court yet, that they're trying to do something with it yet?
Well, it's not, and that's what I want to get a jump start, because the last time I paid them $35,000 in this court case where my brother got caught, and it was a scheme where they brought him on as a state witness, and he wasn't even in the will as far as anything to do with the property.
You can try to challenge the taxes and even take it into the court yourself. And if they try to take it into the court to take your property for taxes, you can challenge the jurisdiction, and you probably win that way. I don't know that anybody's ever done that to them. If people have done it, it's probably rare, so they wouldn't even realize how to deal with it. But that's one of the other things we're working on. Property taxes is unconstitutional, because if you have to pay property tax, then that's a slave tax, and you don't own that property. But with that, we got to move on to the other two. We have two
All
more
right.
people. And
Thank
we
you could, so much, well, everybody.
But I'll try to get that info up for anybody interested in opening up a common law trust.
I would like to have a chance to get a conference with Mr. Winters or and the other gentleman that's on there, Gerard. Gosh, he seemed extremely knowledgeable in what he was. Maybe that could happen. I don't know. I sure hope so, that we might have a conference sometime.
All right.
Thank you.
So you know, you'll have to try to get a hold of Brent. You go to his website, drop him an email, you know?
Yeah, and I read in here tonight, and we need to go on to move some other people, but I read in here tonight in depth what he has about the Common Law Trust. He's a commendable individual.
Brent has some stuff up there on Common Law Trust?
He has some information in there. However, he doesn't have an example of it, as I could find.
I have to go up and take a look and see what he's got, too. So,
yes, sir. It says, our Constitution settles a common-law trust, and it's got parentheses underneath that. Not a civil-law corporation. Then he goes, a common lawyer comments, and then he's got his... There's two different comments of two different individuals. You'll find it in there, or he can drag
right,
you
I'll
to
take
it.
A look. Meanwhile,
maybe
we
do have to draw it up for you. Maybe Brent would be interested
yes,
in doing
absolutely.
It.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, that would be appreciated. And we've got some other things, but we got to yield to some other people.
Yeah,
late.
You should just talk to him and see, because that would take a lot
of time. Absolutely. I'd love to talk with him, but let's move on. Thank you, sir. That's a wonderful comment. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Absolutely, guys.
Okay, thank you.
You too.
Yep. Okay, next. I hit it. It didn't go.
Yeah, it went just
I'm
now.
I'm unmuted. Oh, I see Jay is unmuted. Go ahead, Jay.
Yeah, but so is Crystal. Let's see if Crystal's there first.
Yes. Hello.
Oh, they're both
I'm about
unmuted?
To lose you guys in a second.
Go ahead, Jay. Take Jay first.
Two things.
Long time no talk to, by the way.
I know a friend of mine got a medical exemption for that smart meter.
Oh, no
doctor.
Kidding.
She's extremely sensitive to electromagnetic frequencies, and she got a medical exemption to the smart meter. And another thing was I was going to bring up Rod Glass, and he's got videos online about being a private... Attorney
yeah, that's
general.
Who I was talking about, Rod Glass.
Yeah, I know. You mentioned him, so I'm like, well, there, he stole my thunder. Damn it.
The actual videos are still up. I haven't heard from him. I don't know what's going on.
I don't know. I was watching his videos before I met up with you guys. So, but there are videos explaining what a private attorney general is and everything on YouTube. So
right,
that's
right.
What I was going to mention.
We'd have to look up and see what happened to him. He had a gun
case.
Yeah,
we should study that a little bit.
I don't know how he made out with that. But I didn't hear that he was back in jail or anything like that. Yeah, that poor guy went through all kinds of stuff. But anyway.
Is that it, Jay? All right, thanks a lot, Jay.
We were going to lose him, so go ahead, Crystal.
Hi, how are you? I'm sorry, I just woke up. All righty. Yes. First of all, you're talking about in the private, on the trustee. I got to speak to you more about that. But what's been going on with me? First of all, I have a hearing this week about the guardianship and the trustee and what I did do. Because they gave the property to the criminal. But anyways, I filed another petition against it, and I also filed papers with the criminal justice and all that. And
all
you
right.
Could go on the website. You could go
you
on
made
the
a
website.
Police report.
So, yeah. I just did the police report on Friday, which they refused to take. But anyways, they called me back. I got that in. And they were very, very rude and disrespectful. And said he wasn't going to take it. But
he had no choice anyway.
But anyways, I wrote to the NUCA, the head over the credit unions and all that, because all of them basically denied it. Now it's under investigation again. So that's all. You can go on the electrical file pertaining to my case. When they filed the bankruptcy, it extended more time, but there's so much. And, like, also make sure you do the grievances on all these attorneys. Make sure, back in the beginning, I told everybody, get the names and get all the jurist numbers of every attorney pertaining to each one of their cases, because you're going to be shocked at what you may find on them. That's number one. And even with the courts or whatever the case is, because I hear that the courts, everything is bankruptcy. Last week we went to the courts, there was only one elevator working, and there's a couple of thousand people, so something's going crazy in the courts. It's like a skeleton crew. Everybody's resigning and what have you.
This is it. This is the big rats are leaving the ship, Crystal. And I just want to tell everybody, they don't necessarily know all the particulars of your case, but this week what Crystal found when she went through her paperwork is that this criminal lawyer, he's not a criminal lawyer, he's a criminal because he's criminal, not that he's a criminal lawyer. He forged her name in three different places, and she
he did not forge my name. He terminated my name because I have my warranty deed,
right?
And the property is owned the property, and
he put his name in.
He terminated my name off of my property on the day before the illegal foreclosure took place. Now that everything is forged on it, the dates and all that stuff, you know, nothing is adding up. But see, I could pick that all up, which, you know, because on all the legal documents they got for example, the 19th was supposed to be the illegal foreclosure. He changed it and put in his name on the 18th. How could he change it? And then it was a national holiday. Courts were closed. Then he turned around and filed the paper that said that he filed the papers on the 21st. Courts wasn't even open. But, see, and then another big thing, what everybody better look for on your illegal foreclosures. What they put on there, they said, you abandoned your property. Now, three of the cases we looked at, they put on their property and stole their property a year before the people even put up their property. Another incident where they had the warranty deed, and they wrote abandoned property. How did you abandon the property a year ago when the people were still living there? So these are the things you got to look for. Get your copy of your warranty deed, you know. And number two, who changed your name on the property? You cannot change anybody's documents once you sign a contract. And that was the number one question. Who signed my name? And you know when they call that mirror scan, where they use your name, that's why you got to sign everything in blue, okay?
The MERS, they were doing the robo-signing, wasn't that what they were doing?
That's exactly. And show
so
me
the
proof came.
The point is that people have to know to go in there and get this paperwork and examine it, because the lawyers are not used to anybody looking at what they do, and they're running fast and furious, taking people's properties away, forging documents and removing names and putting names and doing all this stuff, and nobody's watching. The judges aren't watching. The judges are even in on it many of the times. It's RICO. So it's just the fact that you get in there and ask questions and look at these documents, and you'll find all these discrepancies. Go ahead, Crystal.
And also, another thing, just go and get, everybody needs to go and get their copies of your original mortgage, okay, and then right after. And if your mortgage was changed, that means your mortgage was automatically paid for, because you cannot change anybody's mortgage without your signature. And so, like a lot of times, even like when I did mine, Okay, I said, how many times? Like, there was almost like 8 times they sat there and changed it. So every time they change the mortgage, they get the money off your account and your mortgage and stuff. When I, it's just like with the, what was I saying? For the estate and stuff like that, when they are stealing people's property, okay, everybody needs to learn about the life use. And if the mortgage or anything was changed or whatever the case is, use a sworn, a truth of affidavit, and you can put that back on your property. It goes back in your name.
Right.
Anything
right.
you file, okay? And they, again, showing the proof of claim. When it comes to an estate, what is okay, number three, what is the difference between an attorney and a lawyer? An attorney is corporate, and they treat you, anything you put in caps, they treat you like you're a dead person. Okay?
Yeah.
So they're acting and representing of you.
Well, listen, you got to get back. Look, we're going way too late for the tape.
Okay.
So you're
going
to have to get back in next week. That's fine. And we'll
right.
pick it up. And a lot of interesting stuff here. A lot of stuff going on. You did real good rooting it out, Crystal. Unbelievable.
I have my hearing on Thursday, so I will let you know because
okay.
this is the sham where they stole the relative's estate, and I just said so. We got to keep going.
So Monday night call next Monday. We'll have new information coming up on this, and you'll update us. Okay.
Yes, and we'll get that other papers and stuff over to you.
Okay. Thank you, Crystal. Have a good night. Thanks to everybody. Yeah, we appreciate you coming, and see you here next week, same time, same station.
I'll be in touch with you. Bye bye.
Yes. Thank you.